It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster!
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat!
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
Welcome to episode 917 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for a sweltering Sunday here in New York, June 22nd, 2025. Did you miss me? It's good to be back because I've got a ton of news to get into this week and a monster mailbag for you later with your questions. I was catching up with Indy Hartwell's vlog on her YouTube channel, and she included footage from the grand opening of the new House of Glory school in Orlando. Or Oviedo, I guess it is, technically. She was down there for the grand opening. We've got HOG North, now we have HOG South. And she was talking to the Amazing Red, and she revealed, and this is true, I mean, I guess it's safe to say it now, but the original plan when we booked her that first time, she worked with Mercedes Moné back in March, which was a dream match for Indy. You know, she signed up for wrestling school the day after that first Sasha and Bayley match in Brooklyn. But that was not the original plan. It was supposed to be Indy and Private Party against Mercedes, Red, and Brian XL. But for reasons, it did not work out. So we got Mercedes and Indy one-on-one, which turned out great. And now Indy is our champion, and she will be at our Texas debut on July 11th. I hope it's not as hot in Texas as it is in New York this week. It's going to get pretty bad around these parts. Although not nearly as bad as it is overseas right now. What a mess. You know, I have people who listen to this show in Iran, like Ramin and Amir, and people in Israel, like Nir and Tal. I hope everyone stays safe. And of all weeks, WWE is flying its performers out to the Middle East this week, and all kinds of threats are being thrown around. Everything is probably going to be fine for them, but they may have a real issue on their hands if there are any talents who decide they don't feel comfortable flying out that way, you know, in that airspace. They have two shows in Riyadh this week, SmackDown on Friday and Night of Champions on Saturday. I'm sure Saudi Arabia is going to be fine, but who knows how all of this may affect their Saudi plans. I'm sure it'll be a big topic of conversation backstage at Raw tomorrow night. I mean, look, this is a company that used to host shows annually in a literal war zone. I doubt this changes anything. But hopefully I can help take your mind off things as much as possible for a couple of hours. Talk some pro wrestling, which hardly seems like the most important thing going on right now. But we all need an escape sometimes. Thank you to all the folks who supported this week via PayPal and on the YouTube channel. We had a great week over there. TheSoloMonster.com is the place to go if you want to hit that PayPal drop. And thank you guys for the doubles, even though I missed last week's show. I appreciate that. First, shout out to Brad. I'm thinking about you, my friend. Shout out also to James Hollywood Herrera. It's good to hear from you, brother. I hope you're doing well. Big B, Bryant Becerra. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Killshot, Keith Hart, and I also want to give a shout out to Sidro from the YouTube channel, who revealed on social media this past week that he suffered his first heart attack, which is very scary, but he pulled through okay. I think he's doing much better now, wherever he may be at the moment. I assume he's back home. I hope you're doing well, my friend. Hopefully we'll see you on the channel this week. Shout out to Emmanuel. He runs an online store at the following address. So write this down. njpwuj-m5.myshopify.com. Brother, you got to get one of those tiny URLs. It's going to make your life a lot easier. But again, go check it out. He sells sculptures and paintings and other items. I got my hands on one of his sculptures called The Folly of Man. This thing is incredible. Each piece is handmade with a polyurethane resin, and it weighs in at almost 13 pounds. It is a monstrosity, but really well-crafted, and he is offering free shipping on them. So visit njpwuj-m5.myshopify.com and go check out what he has there in the store. Also, shout out to Emerson, who has a clothing brand called Vision. Vision Clothing, that's Vision with a dollar sign instead of an S, where he talks, Vision, what he's talking about is a vision for success when it comes to your goals and your dreams. And they're not just selling products, they're offering pieces that are meant to ignite your ambition. And every item in their collection is curated to inspire confidence in the pursuit of your dreams. And for each t-shirt sold, a portion of those sales will go towards his mom's care as she has been battling MS since 1987. Right now, he is working hard to secure her a new bed. You can check out his store online at whatsyourvision.myshopify.com. Hey, not only can you find me on the YouTube channel this week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but Tuesday, I'll be over on JD's YouTube channel because it is episode 100 of TNT this Tuesday. Funny enough, 100 is what the temperature outside is likely going to be on Tuesday here in New York. But yeah, we are celebrating 100 episodes of Tuesday Night Titans. There's a brand new shirt out, which is badass. And it's been a fun ride. You know, again, I joined, episode 47, I believe, may have been my first episode. It was something that he and Andrew Baydala started a while back before that. We have now done even more episodes than they did together. And so it's been over a year. It's been a lot of fun. I know you guys have had a lot of fun with it, the ones who make it appointment viewing each week. We appreciate it very much. So we're going to have ourselves a little party and talk wrestling, and that'll be on Tuesday night over on his channel at 8:30 Eastern. I hope you guys can join. Variety ran an item this week that USA Network has a new series called The Rainmaker that is slated to premiere on Friday, August 15th at 10 p.m. Eastern. It's a new legal drama. They ran ads for it during SmackDown on Friday night. But take note of the start time. Friday, August 15th. 10 p.m. is when SmackDown is starting its third hour, typically. So that was the first thing I noticed. And then Mike Johnson, per PW Insider, later reported that SmackDown is slated to return to 2 hours on July 4th, which is less than 2 weeks away. Oh, Independence Day this year just took on a very different meaning. I feel like Bill Pullman in the movie. We're finally declaring our independence from 3 hour SmackDowns. Actually, they're doing a double taping that Monday night in Pittsburgh, so they don't have to run live on the holidays. So that first 2 hours SmackDown would be a taped show. Now, it's possible that it goes back to 3 hours the very next week, and they go back to 3 hours for the remainder of July and into August until this Rainmaker show premieres. That has not been made clear anywhere if that's the case or if it's just going to be, 2 hours permanently. As of July 4th, every single week. But who cares? If this report is to be believed, we will finally be done with the three-hour era of weekly television. Now, I'm trying not to get my hopes up too much because I've been burned before. But if it's true, I'm actually very surprised. I really did not think it was going to happen. I really didn't, especially after it was supposed to happen on June 6th. And then the reports came out that USA Network was very happy with it at 3 hours, which of course they are. Of course they are. It's kind of funny that they're premiering this new show when I've been ranting and raving about, like, what shows does this network have anymore? The glory years of USA Network are long gone, and they have a handful of shows. You probably have fingers left over on one hand if you tried to count them all. It's mostly Law and Order reruns and Chicago PD and Chicago this and Chicago that. And so now we're getting this new, legal drama. But these reports were only a few weeks old that they were going to continue on indefinitely at 3 hours. There was another report that WWE isn't even making any additional money off that third hour of SmackDown, which would be completely wild to me. But of course, they're going to be subservient to USA Network and NBC Universal. And if that's what they wanted, then It would be 3 hours. That's why Raw went to 3 hours in 2012, because that's what USA Network wanted. Or Bonnie Hammer, or whoever was in charge at the time. So the fact that they apparently, possibly, are reverting back to 2 hours is very surprising to me, but it's great news. And yes, it means one less hour to showcase talents on the show. But the onus is on Triple H and Road Dogg and the creative team to do a better job of rotating those talents around with the remaining 2 hours that they will now have. The answer should never be simply adding more hours and making the shows longer. And I'm not even talking about adding a new show, which I also think they don't need. But if they added a new show on a different night, that's a different story. I'm talking about tacking on hours to the existing shows and making them longer. That should never be the answer. That is not the answer. The answer is to produce a better television show. Okay, these three-hour shows have more filler than a Real Housewife from Orange County. And I know there are a lot of newer fans and teenagers, younger fans, who are going to say, oh, this is terrible. It has to be 3 hours, right? Remember that guy many years ago in those USA Network ads who was getting the WWE logo tattooed on his body? I work at Walmart, but I make sure I'm home. Don't get it twisted. I'm not a wrestling fan. I'm a WWE fan. Like, that still lives rent-free in my head. There are fans like that who love WWE. They can't get enough of it. They just want more and more and more. They would love it if the show is 4 or 5 hours every single week. So whether you fall into that category or you're a newer fan, whatever it may be, bless their hearts, these people don't know any better. Because they have been conditioned to think that 3 hours is the norm. And that's the way that it should be. It's not. And it never was. It wasn't the answer when WCW did it with Nitro in the late 90s. And it wasn't the answer when USA requested that WWE make Raw 3 hours back in 2012. And it's more fun now to go back and watch a lot of those Nitros than to sit through 3 hours of SmackDown now. Because those Nitros aren't really 3 hours. They probably run less than Raw does now on Netflix. Because you don't have the commercials to sit through like when you would, you know, watch those shows live. It makes a big difference in viewing. But there's a reason that Nitro eventually reverted. Well, there's a lot of reasons, but there's a reason Nitro eventually reverted back to 2 hours. I don't believe that any weekly wrestling show needs to be 3 hours long. I've always been a big believer that less is more. Quality over quantity. There is such a thing as getting too much of a good thing. And it's worse when SmackDown isn't all that good. Now you're getting too much of a not-so-good thing. But I see this argument against the move back to 2 hours. You know, why would you want less show? If it was up to these people, again, the shows would be twice as long as they are now, just to try to get every single person on the roster on the show every single week. So let's look at some of these critiques, because there are valid concerns about there being less television time for certain people. I just went and grabbed a few of the posts that were directed towards me this week. These are three of the criticisms that I've seen. Pat Lantis: how does SmackDown going to 2 hours benefit anyone? We get less chances to see other wrestlers. Cheering a shorter show is stupid. So let's address that. How does SmackDown going to 2 hours benefit anyone? It benefits everyone. Everyone watching the show. When I watch the show on most weeks, it feels like a 2-hour show being stretched out to three because they have an extra hour to fill. It kills the flow of the show. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from people and felt this way myself. Man, that would have been a great show if only it was 2 hours long, but the extra hour dragged it down. Like, I'm not just coming at this from a content creator perspective. I'm coming at this as a fan. If I didn't have this podcast and I didn't have a YouTube channel and went live to like the way I do after these shows every single week, I promise you, I would feel the exact same way. They don't have an exciting enough product to warrant 3 hours every single week. They don't. You should want to leave people with the feeling of, man, that was great. I can't wait for next week. I can't believe that show breezed by. Rather than, oh my God, we got 45 minutes left in this show, which is the way it is on most weeks. Now, if you don't feel that way, great. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of people who don't share that view. The less chance of seeing other wrestlers' part may be an issue. But again, it goes back to Triple H and his team of writers. When they put these shows together, it is simply a matter of adjusting the format to accommodate for the shorter runtime. Yes, you may not get to see the Street Profits every single week, but guess what? You didn't see the Street Profits this week, and the show was still 3 hours. You didn't see the Wyatt Six, and the show was still 3 hours. You haven't seen Rey Fénix at all on SmackDown in 3 weeks. Let's stop pretending that when the show reverts back to 2 hours, all of these people are suddenly going to disappear from television as if some of them haven't already. Same issues that exist now are going to exist a month from now, unless they, being WWE, does a better job of rotating those talents in and out of the show more consistently. We do not need to see everybody on the show at all times. It is okay to skip a week and come back to them as long as they have some sort of story and people are given a reason to want to follow along in their journey. It all comes back to creative. And that problem is not fixed by shaving off an hour. I'm not saying by the show going back to 2 hours, oh my God, SmackDown's going to be great every single week. No, it's a small fix, but you still have to put together a compelling television show. You could still have a boring 2 hour SmackDown. But it's also not fixed by adding another hour. The length of the show actually doesn't have as much to do with it as you may think. Yes, there's more talent now than there was in 1999. When SmackDown was 2 hours long, but they still had a lot of talent on those shows, and they made it work. People got featured. Raw may have been 3 hours for more than a decade, but SmackDown only went 3 hours in January. Before that, it was two, and they made it work. We've been through periods where SmackDown was great, and we've been through periods where SmackDown was shit. It all comes down to creative. And if they need to reorient the rosters a bit to accommodate for one less hour, maybe shift a few names over to Raw, then so be it. But no, to anyone who thinks cheering for a shorter show is stupid, cheering for a shorter show is not stupid. What's stupid is this idea that bigger is always better. Your wife may have told you that. Okay, and if she's happy, congrats, brother, I salute you. But that doesn't make it true when it comes to these TV shows. RPG Jock says, fine, whatever. IWC and the content creators got what they wanted. For what it's worth, SmackDown was the closest thing to a blend of AEW wrestling with WWE storytelling, which I appreciated. You know, it's interesting you say that because Dynamite is 2 hours on most weeks. You don't get any storytelling on Dynamite? This is another fallacy I hear all the time, by the way, that AEW does not tell stories. They do tell stories. You may not like the stories they're telling. You may not find them very engaging, which is fair. And they do tend to throw a lot of wrestling at you, and maybe not enough of the other thing, like the Arena Mexico show this week, but that was a special show. They tried to get as many people on that show as possible. It was just match after match. It's not like that every single week. It was treated more like a house show than anything else. But you say this like, it's over now. That's it. The show used to give you a nice blend of the two, but now it won't. Like, what makes you think that you can't get that in 2 hours? I don't understand. Do you need 15 to 20 minute matches up and down the card every single week? We had Zelina Vega against Piper Niven in a Bakersfield brawl a couple of weeks ago. They got 10 minutes of match time, bell to bell. I agree. There's always the risk that the women may get 2 minute matches, bell to bell, going forward, unless you're Charlotte Flair or Tiffany Stratton. But if instead of 10 minutes, now they get 7 or 8 minutes, you know what? That's a sacrifice I'm willing to accept as a viewer. And that's still a decent amount of TV time. Not every match has to be 12 minutes or 15 minutes long. We got a 15-minute LA Knight JC Mateo match a while back that fucking bored me to tears. Male or female, there are some matches that don't need to be that long. It's okay to shave a few minutes off. Save it for your main event. I see nothing wrong with that. Apostle of Lindau says, everyone complains about talent not being given enough TV time, but celebrate when TV time is cut. Apostle, let me ask you a question. I'm a fan of Aleister Black. Okay, I like the guy. It's not my favorite in all of wrestling, but I like the guy. I want to see him succeed. He's been back in WWE almost 8 weeks now. In that time, he beat The Miz, he beat Carmelo Hayes, and nothing since then. He fell short in his Money in the Bank qualifying match. He fell short in his King of the Ring match, which, you know, again, in those matches, I wouldn't say that they set anything up for him coming out of those matches. They were matches, he was in them, and he didn't win. He never even made it into the ring on SmackDown on Friday for his match with Kit Wilson before R-Truth jumped Wilson from behind, and they threw the whole thing away. He got an entrance at least, but that's about it. Thanks for coming. I'm still waiting for them to get the guy going. Maybe he'll feud with Truth now. We'll see. He should after what happened this week. This is on a 3-hour show. He hasn't done a whole hell of a lot. You may say 2 hours is going to make it even worse. I say it can't get much worse. Right? Just get him into a program with somebody. You know the way Triple H does these slow burn programs. I'm just waiting for him to get into one so the burn can begin. I'm still waiting to feel the burn. People are still bitching about Andrade and Carmelo Hayes not getting enough TV time, and the show is 3 hours long. That's a problem for a lot of people, regardless of the length of the show. I'm not willing to accept a 3-hour show just on the off chance that they'll pull their heads out of their asses one of these days and they'll start giving these guys something more to do. If they don't get featured as much on a 2-hour show, how is that any different than what we are getting now? It's not. And I heard a similar criticism from Obey Marcos. It says, no more time for the women, no more time for tag teams, no more time for guys like Melo and Andrade. Boring bloodline matches, he says. You do realize the longer the show is, the better your chances are that you're going to get boring bloodline matches. You do realize that. And on and on and on and on I've seen this week. It's a minority of the people I saw. Most people seem to agree that the show should be shorter. But at the end of the day, if you are worried about no time for the women or no time for the tag team division, that's an issue of creative more than anything else. And if they do their jobs right, the Street Profits will get time. Fraxium will get time. DIY will get time. The Wyatt Six, which has just died a death. I mean, the start and stop stuff with them has just killed whatever momentum they may have had. But if they do their jobs right, they will find time for all of these people. They just have to do a better job of making the time that they do have really matter. No more filler. No more stretching for time. No more trotting out Raw guys on SmackDown every week to eat up 10 minutes with their fucking entrances. Give me a tighter, more focused show. And in the long run, it'll make for a better presentation. And that concludes this week's lesson. Class dismissed. Justin Barrasso reported this week that Vince McMahon recently tried to purchase controlling interest in the Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship, or BKFC promotion. He noted that David Feldman, BKFC's founder and president, confirmed that a meeting occurred and that McMahon is resolute about a return to promoting. He's a great guy. His whole team is great. But the timing wasn't right for us, said Feldman, who was not willing to relinquish full control of BKFC. He's Vince McMahon. If I were him, I would want creative control too. He was awesome, very complimentary, and he was very serious to do business. Yeah. Real great guy he is. Speaking with several executives in combat sports and pro wrestling, the belief is that McMahon will ultimately find himself involved again in professional wrestling. Those with inside knowledge are not sold on the idea that McMahon's investment firm, 14th and I, is going to suddenly develop television shows or movies, a process that generally takes years to materialize. Perhaps this is a creative way of describing his parent company, similar to how WWE had a parent company in Titan Sports. Speaking with wrestlers off the record, there is a great deal of support for McMahon, as many note McMahon is still held in high regard. But every major wrestler is under contract, so who would he build his wrestling shows around? Would it be weekly programming or large-scale events? Once you start looking at the details, it feels like an insurmountable task, especially with WWE dominating the landscape. And keep in mind, by the way, that he turns 80 years old this August. So it sounds like he's itching to get back in the game, and I'm sure he is. I mean, it's all he's ever known. I can picture him watching the shows every week and just feverishly texting Triple H in all caps, all the things he's doing wrong and how it should be done this way and that way. You know, to the point where Paul has to mute his alerts. when it comes to pro wrestling, the only way he gets back in, okay, in meaning where he runs the whole thing, creative, like the whole deal, or has a role in that sort of thing, would be to buy an existing company or a controlling interest in one. WWE is not for sale. He's not coming back. Tony Khan would cut off his right arm before he would ever sell AEW to Vince McMahon. There's no other company that would even make sense. I cannot see him getting back in the wrestling game and settling for number two or number three. And that's to say nothing of the talent that's available. Like Barrasso said, who would he even build such a promotion around? The only way it makes sense for Vince McMahon to be back in the pro wrestling space is to be back with WWE. And that is not happening. Stephanie McMahon had Nick Khan on her podcast this week. And they actually talked about Vince in terms of his perseverance and his abusive childhood. And they mentioned the Playboy interview from 2001 where he alluded to being sexually abused by his mother. They were putting him over as this empire builder who you can't beat. Can't beat him because you can't beat somebody who had to just survive when he was younger. And Stephanie said nobody can take that away from him, even though his biggest nemesis is probably himself. And that's true. That may be the most honest thing that was said in the entire conversation. Vince McMahon is his own worst enemy. Any problems that he has had in his adult life, not talking about his upbringing or his childhood, any problems that he's had in his adult life, he brought upon himself. Whether it was the Ring Boy scandal, the steroid stuff, the Janelle Grant stuff, and all the countless non-disclosure agreements the Wall Street Journal found out about, all the bad press from all that stuff, he's got nobody to blame but himself for getting into the mess that he got himself into. He's no victim. Great businessman, very successful, ruthless, built a billion-dollar company. Nobody can ever take that away from him, but his downfall is of his own making. And the stain on his legacy, which again, you can't wash that away with dollar bills. I don't care how many billions he has in the bank. The stain on his legacy is there because he put it there. I have no sympathy for anyone like that. Evolution is still 3 weeks away, but if you want to see the closest thing to an all-women show that WWE has, you should watch NXT. That show on Tuesday was dominated by women's segments. They had Evolution Eliminator matches with Jada Parker against Thea Hale, Kalani Jordan against Lash Legend, Zaria against Izzy Dame, and Jordan Grace against Lola Vice. And then they closed the show with Mariah May's contract signing. Or, I'm sorry, Blake Monroe. She got put through a table by Fatal Influence. But also on that show, they had a six-man tag team match with Josh Briggs, Yoshiki Inamura, and Elijah, the former Elias from WWE, who's now with TNA, teaming up against Wesley, AJ Francis, and the TNA World Heavyweight Champion Trick Williams, who got pinned by Inamura in that match. Yoshiki Inamura pinned Trick Williams, the TNA World Heavyweight Champion. Imagine putting your world title on a WWE guy who then turns around and gets pinned in a six-man match by a guy on excursion from Pro Wrestling Noah. I mean, when he pinned Trick, my jaw dropped. But, you know, they're just happy to get the exposure. They may not be so happy that Elijah tore his triceps during that match. He got hurt working a WWE show, and he's going to be out for a long time. Credit to him, though. I don't know how smart it was, but he finished the rest of the match, and it went several more minutes. And it was pretty clear he was hurt because he wasn't using his arm. He did a spot where he basically did the Undertaker's old school on the ropes. Didn't come off the same way Undertaker does, but he came off the ropes, and it was just the way he braced himself with his arms on the landing. He knew right away that he was hurt. And, you know, he tagged in, he tagged out, he tagged in, he tagged out. I mean, he continued the match for several more minutes. But he has already had surgery to repair the injury for a torn triceps. I mean, that's the injury that CM Punk had, you know, both times. So I don't see him being back in the ring for at least 5 or 6 months. The main event for TNA Slammiversary next month has also been confirmed. Slammiversary takes place in New York City at the UBS Arena. Not far from where I am right now. And this was a bit of a surprise. It will be Trick Williams defending the TNA World title, Not against Mike Santana. Not yet, anyway. And no, it will not be against Yoshiki Inamura, although it probably should be. Actually, that will almost assuredly be a television match. But at Slammiversary, he will be defending the TNA World title against Joe Hendry, the former champion. I don't see how Mike Santana does not get into that match. They said Hendry would be challenging for the title, but they never said he would be the only one challenging for the title. I guess we're looking at a multi-man match. We have to be. I mean, there's no way that Mike Santana does not get into that match. Whether it's a triple threat, whether it's some sort of five-man, six-man, King of the Mountain, whatever it is. I am sure that Santana will be in that match. But if it is a multi-man match, it would be very lame to have Santana win the title and not pin Trick to do it. Especially because, you know, Trick's already beaten him on TV, so he should be getting that win back. And Cedric Alexander also made his TNA debut at the Impact taping on Friday night to confront Mustafa Ali. A lot of history between those two from the 205 Live days. Alexander won the Cruiserweight title at WrestleMania one year, working against Ali on the pre-show. But they aired their TV taping live on Friday as a sneak peek, as part of a new free tier on their TNA Plus service. So the show will officially air in its normal slot this Thursday on Access TV. But yes, Cedric is in, so no hurt syndicate for Cedric Alexander. I'm a little surprised by that. Maybe I shouldn't be, though, given the way things went there with his wife. But he's a solid addition to that TNA roster.
Hey, it's Chris VanVleet. Big thank you to Solomonster for letting me jump in here for a few seconds. When this episode is done, I invite you to go check out my podcast, Insight with Chris VanVleet. Some recent guests include AJ Styles, Joe Hendry, Chelsea Green, Seth Rollins, Penta, and Bayley, just to name a few. Also, every Friday, we recap the big wrestling news of the week. Listen to Insight with Chris VanVleet on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts, or look for those interviews on YouTube as well.
There was a story going around this week that WWE may soon be adding a new member or members to Paul Heyman's new group, which remains nameless, with Ethan Page, the current NXT North American champion, or the former champion Ricky Saints, being under consideration to join. That group is still in its infancy. I mean, it hasn't even been a full 90 days yet. I don't really see the need to be adding any more members right now when Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed are still getting their footing. You know, Breakker doesn't even speak. He just barks. He's the silent enforcer. But we haven't heard much from Bronson Reed either. And, you know, in a group with Rollins doing the same shtick that he's been doing for years now, I mean, there's nothing really different about what he's been doing. And he does a lot of the talking, and then you have Paul Heyman sharing in the talking with Rollins. Adding someone like Ricky Saints, who's known for his gift of gab, you know, I worry about how much talk time that he would even get in a group like that. I just don't see the need to add anybody right now. You know, maybe in a few months, in a couple of months, I might feel differently. But unless the idea is to build to War Games with Rollins leading his own team and they need five guys. I mean, look, if you're either one of those guys, you're praying that this happens because you immediately get called up to the main roster at a top spot as part of the top heel faction in the company. So, of course, I'm sure would love to be a part of that group. If I had to choose between those two, I actually think Ethan Page would be the better fit. Ricky doesn't need it. You know, Page could use it more, even if he ends up being the guy who eats the pins for the group, because everyone's group has to have that one guy. I'm not saying he's the next JD McDonagh in the Judgment Day, but I would rather not see Ricky be the one to be taking losses every week for these guys. And here's one more thing. Look, I like Ricky, but to put him in a group standing next to guys like Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed every week, and even Rollins, it's going to make him look small. You know, I don't think that's what he needs. I don't think that visual really helps him. I mean, sure, he could break away in a year or in 18 months and end up being a big babyface, but that should be the goal for Bron Breakker. Breakker should be the one in the Batista spot in this group. Yeah, they were on SmackDown Friday night, and after the match, Reed and Breakker, they took out LA Knight. Three tsunami splashes for LA Knight. That felt like a way to write him off TV for a while. This is after LA Knight called out Seth Rollins at the beginning of the show. So if they are going to be feuding him with Seth and his crew, that gives me hope. that when we see him next, it'll be on Monday Night Raw, which is where he belongs going forward. I've been saying this for a few months now. You move LA Knight to Raw, and if you want to have kind of a one-for-one trade, you move Penta over to SmackDown. It's not like he's involved in anything major on Raw right now. Speaking of Raw, we had the return of Bill Goldberg on Monday night to the surprise of absolutely no one, because Saturday night's main event is coming up pretty quick. It's less than a month away. And the rumor for some time now is that in Atlanta is where he would be having his retirement match. And Goldberg himself in the past has said that, you know, he knows that his final match would be taking place somewhere in the South. So you knew it wasn't going to happen at SummerSlam because SummerSlam is in New Jersey. So Atlanta and his connections to Atlanta and having played for the Falcons in the past and his time in WCW, which was Atlanta-based, like, he's got a lot of roots in Atlanta, and it just made sense. And the last time we saw him on TV was at Bad Blood, which was in Atlanta in October last year. That's when they shot that little angle with him and Gunther. So he comes out on Monday night, and he got a nice ovation. I don't think that a lot of people in the building knew he was going to be there, because I don't think a lot of people in that building have probably been following all the news and rumors about Goldberg as much as maybe you or I have. So he came out there, and he did get a nice reaction. He looked like he was having a little bit of trouble walking to the ring. He has talked about having a bad knee. He can't run on the knee. So I'm sure that's what was giving him trouble, walking to the ring. And he thanked the fans. He told Gunther, "It's all good. Tonight is your night. Tonight, I'm here to celebrate you winning the World Heavyweight title back, because I've been there before. I know how special that is. And you know what? One thing before I go. A few months ago, you started something with me and my family in Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm going to make sure that I end it in Atlanta, Georgia. July the 12th, Saturday night's main event. You're mine, because you're next." At no point in this segment was there ever a mention about the World Heavyweight Championship other than him being there to congratulate, you know, Gunther for winning it back. But there was never a mention of, "I'm coming for the championship," or "I'm going to be champion," or "you put your title on the line." No mention of it. Title was never mentioned, but the graphic that they showed later said it was a World Heavyweight Championship match. That's how they announced this as being a title match, because the graphic on screen said that it was going to be a title match. And they also never said on TV that it was going to be Goldberg's retirement match. And they still haven't acknowledged that on television. Maybe he will tomorrow night. But they have since issued a press release confirming it to be. So it would be one thing if it's like, all right, we all know, because Goldberg has talked about this in the media and on podcasts, that it's going to be his retirement match. But they're taking the approach where on television, they're not going to bring that up. But then they go and they send a press release out. So it's not like this is some state secret here. And he was out there in a t-shirt that said Goldberg's Last Ride. So everybody knows, but they have not yet acknowledged that on TV. Now, he was on the National Football Show. This is what he said. "There's a lot of reasons why I'm doing this. If push came to shove, I would not have planned it at 58 years old, but that's just the way things go. Unfortunately, my last match with WWE contractually was against Roman Reigns in Saudi Arabia. There were a number of things that were wrong with that scenario. First and foremost, me coming off of COVID 3 weeks before. I hadn't trained for 3 months. I had COVID. So to make an extremely long story short, it just wasn't the right way for me to go out. I ain't freaking going out the way that I went out. Period. End of story. So at 58 years old, if I have to go in there hobbled, if I have to go in there 30 pounds lighter, I don't give a shit, because I have a point to make. And at 58 years old, can I still make that point? I don't know. But I'm going to do my best. And my best, 50% of me is better than 99% of the pricks on the planet, I do believe. If I still give that effort and have the work ethic, although I'm not who I used to be, I mean, I don't lose that. But it's a risk. It's a huge risk. Am I risking the legacy of Goldberg in the ring? Yeah. Every time you step in there, you risk that. But it's risk versus reward. So let's get honest here about Goldberg. Goldberg at his peak. Okay, you want to know what Goldberg's peak was in professional wrestling? It was July of 1998. That is when Goldberg peaked. when he pinned Hulk Hogan in the Georgia Dome to win the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. That was the top of the mountain for him. That was the peak. His popularity, he was white hot at the time. His popularity since then has only been on the decline. And he's still very popular, but it never, ever reached that height ever again. And no one is taking away the fact that he came out, I mean, like, just out of nowhere in 97. Nobody knew who this fucking guy was. Black boots, black trunks, goes out there, wins his matches quickly, goes back to the showers. He was one of the very, very few true stars, superstars, that WCW made during that Monday Night War period. It was Goldberg, it was DDP, and it was Booker T. You know, Sting was there, but Sting had already been there for many years. Okay? Goldberg was like the one true big top star during that period of time. And that is part of his legacy. But when he came back to WWE, because his WWE run the first time was very forgettable. And he'll be the first to tell you that he was not happy with that run. That's why after a year he left. He's like, I'm not staying here. One of his first nights in, they put fucking Goldust wig on him. It's like, once they did that, you could tell, like, okay, this is probably not going to go the way it went for him in WCW. So he left, and it seemed like that was that. And then 2016, all these years later, he comes back. And he beats Brock Lesnar in 90 seconds at Survivor Series, right? Shocks the world. And then they put the championship on him. He goes to WrestleMania. He has a rematch with Brock. And it's a 6-minute match. And it's the best possible 6-minute match that you will ever see Bill Goldberg have. Like, what they did was basically, okay, bell rings, balls to the wall, suplex, finisher, spam. Like, that's really all it was. But that's all it had to be. And if Goldberg would have gone out on that note, I think that would have been a high note for him to go out on. But then he came back again, and we all know what happened with him and The Fiend in Saudi Arabia, and they put the championship on him, and we're going to do Roman and Goldberg, right? The University of, was it Georgia Tech against the, who gives a shit, whatever. But that was going to be the idea behind the match. And then everything got shut down. Roman did not work WrestleMania that year. So he ended up dropping the belt to Braun Strowman in a 4-minute match in an empty warehouse. And then he came back again. He had matches with Bobby Lashley. Before that, he had the match in Saudi against Roman Reigns, which was not good. He almost killed The Undertaker in another match in Saudi Arabia. That was truly one of the worst matches of all time. And there's been nothing since that WrestleMania match with Brock, where they avenged, right? They were able to wipe the slate clean on that awful WrestleMania match they had in 2004. There's been nothing he's done since that match in 2017 that would warrant or justify him being back in the ring. That would have been the time for him to quit. When he first came back, he said, I'm coming back because my son never had the chance to see me perform live. Well, his son had the chance to watch him perform live. Like, all the things he wanted to do, he did. But I'm sure the paycheck was such that, you know, it was a hard thing to turn down. And hey, if I could just pop up once every 5 or 6 months and hit a spear and a jackhammer, sure, why not? Right? That was the idea behind it. But there's been nothing that Goldberg has done since then that makes me want to see him again in the ring. There's been nothing since then that he has done that makes me excited at the prospect of seeing Bill Goldberg back in the ring. And I'm even less excited when I hear him on his show talk about and admit the fact that he is working hurt, that he's almost 60 years old and he's hobbled by all of these injuries, but he feels like, I need this. This is my closure. This is the match that I was promised by Vince McMahon. He was very upset that he was promised a retirement match and then it never happened. So for him, I hope it all goes well. I hope he gets the closure he's looking for. But I cannot sit here and tell you that I am excited to see Bill Goldberg back in the ring against Gunther for the World Heavyweight Championship in a match that does not need to be for the World Heavyweight Championship. And what I thought was so incredibly dumb was the way that they went about announcing this whole thing on Monday. When there's a very simple story that they could have told that actually would have made a lot more sense. And frankly, would have made it a lot more compelling, which is Gunther saying, you know what? You got a problem with me? all right, you want a shot at my world heavyweight championship? I'm willing to give you a shot at my world championship, but you're going to have to put something on the line yourself. Your career. And then you get to title versus career on Saturday night's main event. That would have been far more compelling. Now, maybe that still happens, but here's the thing. If Goldberg comes out on Raw tomorrow night, okay, let's say he's on the show, because I don't know if he's going to be on Raw every week between now and then, but he is supposed to be on television a few times. So let's say he's there tomorrow night. Even if he comes out now and volunteers the fact, this is going to be my retirement match, or I'm willing to put my career, like, it doesn't make sense now because the match has already been made official. The time to do that would have been before making this official as a championship match, and they didn't do that. Goldberg now has no real incentive to accept such a stipulation if they wanted to tell that story. Like, even if Gunther came out and asked him to put his career on the line, it doesn't make any sense. So I just think it was a missed opportunity to do things in a way that would have made a lot more sense and would have made the match more compelling. But it's almost as if they don't care. They just want to get it out of the way. Let's just get this shit over with. We'll put the press release out. We'll just announce it. It's a title match. I'm seeing these reports that Jey Uso lost his world title when he did because Triple H made the call he wanted this to be a title match. He wanted this to be a title match so badly he couldn't even put in 5 seconds of thought to make it make sense on television and do it in the right way. Lazy. Lazy is the word I think of when I think of how they've set this match up. Now, is it possible that Goldberg might actually win? Would he win the world championship only to then have Seth Rollins cash in his money in the bank and immediately take the title away from him? Sure. Is it possible? Absolutely, it's possible. Do I like the idea? No, because that means that Goldberg beats Gunther to win the world heavyweight championship. Unless the idea is that Seth cashes in and turns it into a triple threat match. Yeah, which I guess would be fine. But again, just the way that this whole thing has even come to be, it really does. It feels like this is something that it's like doing jury duty. It's like, oh, shit. You know, you look at the date on the calendar. It's like, all right, I got my summons. I have to go do this shit. Let's just get this shit over with. Let's just get this shit over with. And so I'm just sitting here hoping that I don't get picked on this jury to prolong this. And it's just a one and done thing, which is what this should be for Bill Goldberg. Also, on Monday night, there was a very unfortunate injury during a match between Liv Morgan and Kairi Sane. It actually came on the very first spot of the match. This may have been the fastest injury that I have ever seen in a match after the bell rang. Kairi went for a takedown. Liv came up injured. And she rolled out of the ring. She was holding her arm and her shoulder. And then they put the camera on Kairi in the ring, and they said, oh, the doctor is going over to check on, because at first I thought maybe this is, you know, part of an angle they're doing. Because remember, you know, Liv kind of went out there on her own in a huff because Raquel was backstage licking her wounds from earlier in the show. Liv was like, hey, let's go plan strategy for Kairi. And Raquel's like, oh, I'm not medically cleared. And so Liv was in a bad mood. And I thought, oh, all right, maybe they're setting some kind of an angle up here. But then they said the doctor went over to go check on Liv, and then they cut away to commercial. And that's when you know, okay, something happened here. And when they came back, they showed a bunch of replays of what happened. And if they didn't tell you that she got hurt, you would never know that she got hurt. All she did was put her arms out to brace her fall. And the way she landed, it was like right on her elbows. Yeah, but it's not like the elbow looked like, oh, yeah, the elbow snapped. Like, no, nothing like that. But she immediately reacted like she was hurt. So they came back and Kyrie's music was playing and they showed the announcers at ringside and Michael Cole informed us that the match had been stopped due to injury. And later on, he said that the update was she suffered a dislocated shoulder. And I mean, the recovery time from a dislocated shoulder could be anywhere from weeks to months. It all depends on the severity of it. And we got an update on Wednesday as to the severity of it per PW Insider. Liv Morgan's dislocated shoulder will require surgery, PW Insider has learned from multiple WWE sources. This is pretty much the worst case scenario, as it means she will be out for a lengthy amount of time. And other reports are now saying it could be up to 6 months. So that sucks. That really sucks. And that really is a worst case scenario, because if she didn't need surgery, at least she could still be on TV you know, probably right away if they wanted her there. And I'm not saying she can't be on TV. We're not going to see her at all for 6 months. But with surgery, you know, let the woman heal. There's going to be a period of healing that's needed. And she's going to be off television for a while, however long that may be. She is going to be off TV for a little bit. And the entire Judgment Day storyline that they have been building really does revolve around her. I mean, Dom and Finn have been having issues now for months, but a lot of it stems from her really driving that wedge between the two of them. And, you know, going behind Balor's back to get Dom a title match, which is how he won the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania in the first place, and all of that. So she's been in the middle of everything, not to mention the stuff with Raquel, one half of the women's tag team champions. Kairi, a few days later, took to social media to comment on the injury, and this is what she wrote. "One of the most painful things for me is when a match is decided not by wrestling, but because of an injury. I always step into the ring with deep respect for my opponent, and I train hard every day to give the audience something they can truly enjoy. Even if it was never intentional, knowing that someone was hurt in a match with me is something I carry deeply. It breaks my heart. I hope with all my heart for a full and speedy recovery. I will continue to give my all, hoping to bring excitement, not pain, to the ring." Well, I mean, you got to bring pain to the ring. I mean, come on. You got to keep some kayfabe here, right? That's what you go to the ring for. So that was a nice statement there by Kairi, and it didn't stop people from criticizing this woman and saying that it's her fault and she's reckless or she's sloppy or, yeah, because after what happened in the Money in the Bank qualifier with Kairi in what was her first night back, by the way, that was her first match back, and she had been out for like 6 months, and it was Rhea Ripley, Kairi Sane, and Zoe Stark. And there was that spot where Zoe did the springboard off the ropes. Kairi was not in the position that Zoe expected her to be in. And the way that Zoe landed on her leg, she wrenched her leg. And she ended up tearing her ACL, her MCL, her meniscus, and she's going to be gone for a very long time. In a situation like that, you could say, well, you know, Kairi was out of position for the move, right? And look, shit like that happens. It's not as if this is a recurring constant thing with Kairi where people are getting seriously injured because she's not where she's supposed to be. But it just, unfortunately for her, not long after that, this happens. And so people go, oh, well, Kairi's unsafe to work with. This was a freak accident. If you go back and watch what happened, Kairi Sane did absolutely nothing wrong. Liv Morgan did absolutely nothing wrong. It just happened. She put her arms out. She's had shoulder issues before. You know, the last time when she missed months because of, I think she had surgery, I believe, on her shoulder. I don't know if it was the same one, but she's had issues with her shoulders before. It could just be for Liv that, you know, she just has a part of her anatomy that's a little more sensitive than others, unfortunately, and maybe a little more prone to injury. But that's not her fault, and it's not Kairi Sane's fault. And I don't want to hear anybody blaming Kairi Sane for this because that's fucking dumb. And the fact that this woman took all this abuse from all the mutants on social media this week is ridiculous, but I would expect nothing less of them. Now, for Liv, it sucks for her to get hurt this close to Evolution, right after they shot that angle last week with Nikki Bella, who apparently was there. She was in the back and she was supposed to come out, and they decided not to have her come out after this. Her injury is going to affect several different people, not just Nikki Bella and maybe Brie. Depending on what the actual match for Evolution was going to be. I still believe it was going to be a women's tag team title match. You've got Brie Bella. She was on the red carpet for some event. I don't know what the hell was the event. I don't even know what it was. But she was being interviewed by somebody and said that, WWE hasn't even called me. You know, they have my number. Call me. I don't buy that for a second. I think they were setting up for the Bellas to challenge for the women's tag team titles at Evolution. Whether they were or if they were going to do a singles match, obviously that match is off now. And so Nikki Bella is affected by this. Raquel Rodriguez is affected by this. Roxanne Perez is affected by this. Potentially Io Sky is affected by this. They had a segment at the beginning of the show where the two of them came face to face. You know, and again, all the storyline stuff with the Judgment Day. But there is an obvious backup plan here, as she is one half of the women's tag team champions. Now, the obvious answer is to just burn the belts in a bonfire. That's not going to happen. The obvious backup plan here is have Roxanne Perez take her place alongside Raquel. There's no need to even strip them of the titles. There's no need to vacate the titles. is what I said on Monday night. You could slide Roxanne in her spot. It just feeds into the existing heat on screen with her and Liv that much more. By the time Liv comes back, she may end up being a babyface out of all this. Rhea Ripley and Liv Morgan may be standing side by side with each other at the end of all this. But if they can get Liv back on television, let's say, I don't know, in a month or a few weeks, and she can continue to heal while also appearing on television, all this would do would just feed into the heat and feed into the jealousy between her and Roxanne, and you can continue to tell that story even if she can't get physical. So that's, and I don't know that that's what they're planning on doing, but to me, depending on what their long-term plans are for Roxanne, maybe they have some better plan for her, but that's what I would do. And we got some updates on the King and Queen of the Ring. Asuka is back. She made her return to the ring, her first match back Monday night since Backlash last year. 13 months later, she's back. She beat Stephanie Vaquer, Raquel Rodriguez, and Ivy Nile to advance to the semifinals, where she pinned Alexa Bliss on SmackDown Friday night, which means that she is going to the finals to meet the winner of the match tomorrow night between Jade Cargill and Roxanne Perez. Now, on the men's side, Jey Uso outlasted Bronson Reed, Sheamus, and Rusev to advance to the semifinals tomorrow night. He's going to be taking on Cody Rhodes. And this past Friday on SmackDown, Randy Orton pinned Sami Zayn, which for me was a mild surprise. I can't ever say that Randy Orton winning is a surprise, but it was a mild surprise for me. I thought Sami would at least go to the finals, even if he didn't win the entire thing, that they would want him in Saudi in that match. I still think there's a good chance his path is a Royal Rumble win in Saudi next year, and he wins that first world title at WrestleMania. They're playing it up too much on TV for that not to be his story. You know, they did it again Friday night. You know, I'm the only one in the ring right now that's not been a world champion, and I'm going to be a champion. And even Randy Orton said, I believe one day you're going to be a champion. It's just not going to be SummerSlam. SummerSlam's not going to be that day, he said. But they keep bringing this up on television for it not to be, I think, his story going into WrestleMania next year. Now, that leads us into Night of Champions, which is set for next Saturday in Riyadh with a 1 o'clock Eastern start time. Let's run this card down and do predictions. First, though, we actually have some title matches on SmackDown this Friday in Riyadh, less than 24 hours earlier. Zelina Vega is going to defend the Women's United States Championship against Julia. Julia has not been on the main roster for very long, and here she is challenging for a championship. I said this even, and if you're going to say, well, you know, I mean, hey, Solomonster, I mean, what has she done to earn a title shot? Well, I'll tell you what she's done. I said this even before Julia had her Money in the Bank qualifier, that I would have her pin Zelina Vega in that match to qualify. That way, coming out of Money in the Bank, which I never expected her to win, she has a claim to challenge for the U.S. title because she pinned the champion. And that's exactly what they did, and here we are. And if you're going to have champions get pinned on TV, then the person who pins them should get a championship match. And this should be a title change. By the way, I had a good laugh when I saw the video. You may not have seen it. They put it up as an exclusive on their social media channel yesterday. WWE put this, it's not even a video package. They basically filmed dueling promos backstage. So they had one from Julia, and then they cut to one from Zelina, cutting promos on each other. This did not air on SmackDown for some inexplicable reason. 3 fucking hours, they couldn't find time for this. So they used subtitles for Julia's promo. And she spoke some English at the end, and she actually sounded very good. But for the Japanese portion, they had subtitles. And the part where she spoke Japanese, she said at one point, "The championship means a lot to you. It doesn't to me." I was like, that woman is being honest. That's what she's being in this promo. You know, Zelina talks about the title and protects it with her life. And this woman is out there flat out saying, I don't care about the U.S. title. You know, to her, she says it's just a stepping stone, which it is. But just to say that out loud, I just wasn't expecting that. All the more reason for her to win it. She can make it really mean something. So I think she wins the U.S. title. We have the Street Profits defending the WWE Tag Team Championship against the Wyatt Six, Joe Gacy and Dexter Lumis. it's too soon to put the belts on Gacy and Loomis. And after that last match they had against Sabin and Shelley a couple weeks ago, it was not very good. Maybe they're just, you know, a little rusty because it's not like they've gotten a lot of ring time recently. That was not a great match, though. It definitely does not feel like the right time for this. The Profits will retain. The Profits haven't even had it that long. Street Profits are going to retain. And then in a last woman standing match for the WWE Women's Championship, it'll be Tiffany Stratton defending against Nia Jax. Now, I've gone back and forth on whether or not Naomi cashes in her money in the bank here. For sure, if they close the show with this match, I think she does. But my prediction is that regardless, I think Naomi is cashing in successfully on Tiffany Stratton this Friday to win the Women's Championship. I think they do the women's cash in on Friday, and I think they save the men's cash in either for Saturday night's main event or for SummerSlam. And that leads us into Night of Champions, which is currently five matches. We have Dominic Mysterio defending the Intercontinental Championship against AJ Styles. Dominic winning, I think, is the outcome here. I have him retaining the title, although it is nice to see AJ challenging for a championship for a change. We have the Queen of the Ring final. It will be Asuka on one side, challenging either Jade Cargill or Roxanne Perez. We'll know after tomorrow night. Jade is likely winning tomorrow, since we already have a Raw talent in the finals. I think they would want to have one from Raw, one from SmackDown here. I would love to see Asuka against Io at SummerSlam for the Women's World title. They can still do that even if Asuka does not win this match. I'm going with Jade. I think we're getting Queen Jade. That's my prediction. I was going to go with Asuka, but I don't see them having Jade lose to her, not without help from someone. You know, but the reason I was considering Asuka really was, a Raw star is due for a big win. I was thinking about this. Look at what we have had so far this year. Charlotte Flair, a SmackDown talent, wins the Royal Rumble. Bianca Belair, a SmackDown talent, wins the Elimination Chamber, even though she ended up challenging for the Raw title at WrestleMania. Naomi, another SmackDown talent, wins Money in the Bank. They're winning all of these things. It feels like it's time for the Red Team to get a win. But I'm going to stick with Jade on this one, right? That's assuming she gets past Roxanne tomorrow night. If for some reason she doesn't get past Roxanne, which would shock me, then I would go with Asuka over Roxanne in the final. So here's how I've got it mapped out. Okay, I'm going to throw this out there. You tell me what you think. Naomi cashes in successfully on Tiffany this Friday. She wins the title. Jade wins Queen of the Ring. She challenges Naomi at SummerSlam. And Bianca Belair screws Jade Cargill out of the championship by going heel and realigning with Naomi. I was not sold on them actually doing it and turning Bianca heel, but the more I think about this scenario, I can fuck with it. We have the United States Championship on the men's side being defended by Jacob Fatu. He's putting his title on the line against Solo Sikoa. This is a match I thought we might get at WrestleMania. And if not WrestleMania, we might get it a backlash. But we're finally getting it here. They set the angle up on Friday night. You know, where Jimmy Uso stands in all this, because we saw Jimmy Uso come out to make the save when, Jacob was getting attacked by JC Mateo and Solo. And, you know, Jacob shared a glare with Jimmy. Is Jimmy going to go heel? Like, I hope not. I don't know where Jimmy fits. Jimmy is just, he's lost, right? They say Roman Reigns is on the island of relevancy. I think Jimmy is on Gilligan's Island, and nobody's found him yet. I don't know what's going on with him, but we have heard the reports. We've seen the video clips on social media of Hikuleo finally reemerging, like the sea monster. He's been hiding, and now he's reemerged, and he has had, I think it was a match for main event last week, and this week it might have been a dark match. He hasn't been on television yet. But the fact that he has reemerged and he's getting in the ring tells you that they obviously have a plan to finally debut him on TV. And I think it happens here. And I think what has to happen is that Solo Sikoa needs to win this first match. Solo Sikoa needs to win the United States Championship. And I think he wins the United States Champion. I know he's got JC Mateo, but I think he gets the assist from the newest member of the Bloodline, Hikuleo. whether they call him Hikuleo or Tala Tonga, whatever they want to call him. I think he debuts here, and I think he helps Solo win the title. And then Jacob has to not only chase to get the belt back, but in the interim, he's got to go through these other Bloodline members before he can get back to Solo, whether that's SummerSlam or Clash in Paris or whenever it may be. I don't see this story ending here. And if Jacob beats him, it's over. Like, if he beats him, it's over. There's no reason to prolong this. So I don't know why you would just have him go in there and beat Solo straight up. That's why I think Solo wins the belt. And we have the King of the Ring final. Randy Orton has punched his ticket. We already know he's going to be in this match. He was in the finals last year of the King of the Ring, and he lost to Gunther. So he's getting a second chance this year. He's getting a second chance to lose. Because whoever is going to be on the other side of the ring from him is winning King of the Ring. And that's either going to be Cody Rhodes or it's going to be Jey Uso. I got Cody Rhodes winning this thing. Cody and Jey are having their match, semifinal match, on Raw tomorrow night. Not that I'm sure they wouldn't love to have Jey Uso in Saudi Arabia, but I find it hard to believe they would not have Cody Rhodes on that show. I think Cody wins. I think what we're looking at here is a straight line. You don't have to overthink it. I think we get King Cody. He uses the crown as a way to guarantee himself a rematch with John Cena at SummerSlam for the WWE Championship. All roads lead to the Cody-Cena rematch. And the thing about this, if we get Cody and Randy, which is a match I've been waiting for them to do, and I think there's a very good chance we're going to get it next weekend, you can use this match and a Cody win as a catalyst for a longer feud between them. Maybe after Cody wins the belt back. Yeah, you know, once Cody is done with John Cena, John Cena then can begin his babyface turn. And we can move on to Cody and Randy. But whatever happens here in the finals, if Randy loses to Cody, you can use that as the catalyst to whatever comes next. Whether Randy goes heel or whatever. They just continue a friendly feud. Whatever it looks like. That's how I see this playing out. Could Jey Uso win? Could Jey Uso beat Cody and wrestle Randy Orton next weekend? Yeah. But, I mean, to me, that's the least compelling match that they could do. I don't really have any interest in seeing that. And I don't see Randy Orton winning. So if Jey Uso goes to the finals, that means he probably wins. And so what are we looking at? Are we looking at Jey Uso against Gunther again at SummerSlam? Is Seth Rollins going to cash in during Goldberg and Gunther, as I mentioned earlier, is a possibility, and then he wins the world title on Saturday night's main event, and we get Seth and Jey. That I could see. That's why I can't sit here and say, oh, Cody's of course going to win. No, you know, there's... I don't want to say 50-50. I say 60-40. I would go 60-40 as far as my confidence level in Cody winning tomorrow night, but I'm still sticking with Cody. I think Cody gets the nod. He goes to the finals and he wins the entire thing. And then for one last time, most likely, I guess we can't be sure, but most likely for the final time, John Cena and CM Punk will step into the ring against each other one-on-one. This is going to be their first singles match since 2013 when they had that match to decide who was going on to WrestleMania to challenge The Rock for the WWE Championship. And we know how that turned out. We got to see them interact a little bit in the Elimination Chamber earlier this year. And for those few minutes, they recaptured some of that magic because these two have had some classic matches before. Now, John Cena was in the ring against R-Truth on SmackDown Friday night. They had an absolute nothing match. They had a 5-minute throwaway match that ended on a disqualification, just the lamest shit you can imagine. CM Punk came out when it was over. Cena laid him out. He gave him an attitude adjustment through a Slim Jim table in the ring. And as CM Punk slept in the middle of the ring and took a nap, he went Betty Bye for a little bit. John Cena took the microphone. He didn't go to the stage. He just sat on top of one of the turnbuckles in the corner. And he proceeded to cut his version of CM Punk's pipe bomb. He reenacted the pipe bomb. He borrowed some of the verbiage from the original pipe bomb, which ironically, you know, when the pipe bomb promo happened, it came right after a John Cena R-Truth match on Raw in 2011. And so history has a funny way of repeating itself here. But some of the things that Cena said during this promo, he mentioned, you know, you're no longer the voice of the voiceless. You're a friggin' millionaire. You're not punk. You're capitalist. You're not against TKO, dude. You're Mr. TKO. In Saudi Arabia, you're going to face some loud music when I finally prove to the world no days off for 25 years that I have been the greatest of all time. And the fans know that you were the best in the world for 7 minutes, 14 years ago. And if after Night of Champions you're still delusional enough to believe that you are the best in the world, well, I guess it's a small world after all. Thanks for letting me rip off your promo to make you look even more foolish. Those really were the key takeaways from this. Everybody's going to be all hung up on him mentioning Claudio Castagnoli and mentioning Nick Nemeth and mentioning Matt Cardona. And why did he pick them? Is it because, you know, Matt, Nick, and Claudio, you know, Claudio Castagnoli, CC, because he didn't call him Cesaro. Called him Claudio Castagnoli, CC. It's like Colt Cabana. Like, everyone's a detective now. Everyone's trying to figure this out. That's not even the biggest takeaway from this promo. The parts that I just mentioned really were the key takeaways. I'm not going to, and nor did I on Friday night. I didn't glaze this in the way that a lot of other people did. There was a lot of people saying this was the promo of the year and maybe the promo of the decade. And, you know, we're back, baby. You know, heel Cena finally and all this stuff. And it's like, this was nothing earth-shattering. Like, it was good. It was a good promo. It was a knockoff of the original pipe bomb. Only this time it was Cena throwing it back in Punk's face for being a hypocrite. And that aspect of it I liked. You know, for turning into the very thing, and this was the key takeaway here, turning into the very thing that he once hated, that he once despised. That's what they're doing with this story of Punk having to chase Cena all the way to Saudi Arabia if he wants to challenge for the WWE Championship. Punk has to be a hypocrite if he wants to get Cena in the ring for that title. It's a very clever way of getting Punk on that show, you know, and storyline-wise, giving him a reason, even though the comments he's made in the past, why is he going to Riyadh? Well, because it's the only way that he can get John Cena in the ring and get a shot at the WWE Championship. CM Punk brings out the best in John Cena. John Cena brings out the best in CM Punk. I've said before, it's the fact that they are so polar opposite that just makes this work. What we get from these two may be the peak, frankly, of this John Cena heel turn, which has been very underwhelming. It's been very paint-by-numbers stuff otherwise. You will never convince me otherwise. This heel run so far has been a huge letdown. Could he redeem it with this? Yeah, well, I mean, it may be over after next weekend, but like I said, this may be the peak of it. You know, if they go back to Cena and Cody and we get more of the same from those two, it's hard for me to imagine, you know, that being all that different from, you know, what they did on the road to WrestleMania. This may be the peak of this John Cena heel turn. But the thing is, like, this should have been their big summer program heading into SummerSlam. This should not have been rushed for Night of Champions. And maybe it will be. Maybe they will run this back at SummerSlam. Let's say the King of the Ring winner ends up coming from Raw and challenges. Let's say that Jey Uso goes. I'm wrong, and Jey Uso goes to the finals and he beats Randy Orton, right? And they do Jey Uso against Gunther, Jey Uso against Seth, right? If Seth cashes in, then you can still, on SmackDown, set things up with Cena and Punk, even though Punk's a Raw guy, but that doesn't seem to really make much of a fucking difference anymore. So who's to say we don't get John Cena and CM Punk one more time at SummerSlam, right? You could theoretically do that. But then I don't know what you do with Cody Rhodes. Seems very unlikely to me. What I can tell you, though, is that CM Punk is not winning the WWE Championship. John Cena will be leaving Riyadh as he enters it as the undisputed WWE Champion. So those are my predictions for Night of Champions. I will be live on YouTube next Saturday after the show is over for the full review immediately after, so join me then. We'll have some fun. Today's episode is sponsored by Factor Form. We all try to eat better or take supplements that we think are going to be good for our overall health. I've tried a couple of powders before, greens powders that tasted like chalk, and I could barely stand it. I couldn't imagine taking them every day, so that didn't last long. It's one thing to tolerate something you think might be good for you, even if it tastes terrible, but it's even better to find something you actually can enjoy using, so you're not torturing yourself. That's what I was able to find, finally, with Daily Greens by Factor Form. Factor Form is the sister brand to Factor Meals, which you've heard me talk about before. I'm a big fan of their meals as well. Factor Form was designed to work hand in hand with your Factor Meals, making the goal of better nutrition a hell of a lot more attainable, especially for people with very busy schedules who may think they don't have the time to worry about this kind of thing. Now there's no need to dread drinking greens. Daily Greens is a greens powder by Factor Form that in one scoop delivers 100% of your daily nutrients, filling whatever nutrient gaps you may have while supporting full body health and helping you feel your very best. It has a refreshing, citrusy taste that's actually enjoyable to drink. Just mix a single serve pack with water and you're good to go. It's nice to have a greens drink that doesn't taste like my neighbor's dead lawn. Daily Greens by Factor Form is made from real vegetables packed with a whole serving of kale and spinach without tasting like it. In fact, in a blind taste test, Daily Greens ranked number one in taste, texture, and aroma, beating out the biggest names in the industry. Factor Form's Daily Greens is packed with prebiotics, probiotics, and adaptogens to support gut health and reduce bloating. No added sugar, no artificial fillers, just whole food ingredients that work. So much so that 88% of users experienced improved digestion and gut health. I've been trying it out myself the past couple of weeks, and it's definitely been better than some of the others I've tried in the past. Start your day right with Daily Greens by Factor Form at factor75.com/solomonster to get 40% off plus free shipping on your first order. That's factor75.com/solomonster for 40% off plus free shipping. factor75.com/solomonster. John Alba had an exclusive for Sports Illustrated this week on a lawsuit filed against John Moxley and AEW for negligence, civil assault, and battery by a former production crew member. Let me read to you here from this story. A production crew member who has worked with All Elite Wrestling since 2019 has filed a civil lawsuit against the company and AEW World Champion John Moxley. In it, he alleges various degrees of negligence by AEW and Moxley, alongside civil assault and battery against Moxley concerning an incident on Dynamite in 2023. The lawsuit was filed against the parties on May 30th in the Wayne County Circuit Court by Christopher Dispensa, a longtime wrestling and entertainment production crew member who started doing contract work with AEW in 2019. Dispensa is not a direct employee of AEW and provided services to Broadcast Service Group, which supplies crew for the company. His legal team told the Takedown on SI that he has not done work with AEW since December 5th, 2024, and was demoted by Broadcast Service Group to the role of carpenter without explanation. As of Monday morning, it had not yet received a response to the filing from the promotion. Dispensa claims that he suffered severe neck and shoulder injuries as a result of being shoved to the ground unexpectedly by Moxley during a match with Kenny Omega. Dispensa alleges in the lawsuit that the incident resulted in him requiring cervical fusion surgery, shoulder surgery, and treatment for other unspecified injuries. Dispensa said that the injuries occurred on the May 10th, 2023 edition of AEW Dynamite in Detroit. There, Moxley faced Omega in a cage match, which ended up spilling to the outside. No. You're telling me a steel cage match ended up outside the cage? I don't believe it. Moxley went to grab a screwdriver to use on Omega, and in doing so, shoved Dispensa to the ground. The lawsuit claims Moxley was supposed to only grab the screwdriver, and Dispensa took an unplanned fall as a result of being shoved. His legal team alleges that this is an example of civil assault and battery, claiming that in allegedly deviating from the script, Moxley either showed intent to harm Dispensa or, at a minimum, a complete disregard for whether harm was a result. The lawsuit alleges that Moxley had a history of disciplinary issues before this incident involving other people while under AEW's employ, agency and or contractual relationship. It also says that past disciplinary offenses by Moxley include a documented history of unpredictability as well as a lack of control by defendant AEW, all of which were known or should have been known to the defendant AEW at the time of this assault. However, multiple high-level AEW sources with knowledge of Moxley's working history with the company told the Takedown on SI that they were unaware of any history of disciplinary issues with Moxley, noting that he is respected within the promotion by talent and management. One referred to him as a locker room leader and disputed the characterization of Moxley given in the lawsuit. Filing also claims Moxley and AEW are responsible for exhibiting gross negligence, suggesting by going off script and violently shoving plaintiff, who was only a crew member, to the ground, Moxley demonstrated a substantial lack of concern for whether a severe injury would result to a production crew member at the event. In taking no precautions or preventative measures to protect production staff, defendant AEW's actions likewise show a reckless disregard for the safety of production staff, which goes beyond simple inadvertence. The complaint also accuses AEW of negligence in hiring and training Moxley. Training him, really? I love it. Who exactly trained John Moxley while he was under employ here to AEW? I would love to know. A portion of Count 1 claims AEW has a responsibility to exert reasonable control over its employees, agents, and/or contracted individuals to ensure the safety of other performers, production crew, and the general audience. The 39-year-old Moxley has been wrestling since 2004 and has worked for not only AEW, but WWE, TNA, New Japan Pro Wrestling, and other promotions throughout his career. Dispense's legal representation tells the Takedown on SI that he claims AEW upper management was aware of the incident, but says he never discussed it with them. He alleges to have met with Tony Khan and AEW General Counsel Chris Peck about potential full-time employment opportunities in the months after the incident, but acknowledged that there was never a prior conversation about the injuries he says he sustained. His attorney also noted Dispenza said he never filed an official incident report that night because he had another job on tour that he had to get back to, but he claimed that he spoke with three individuals that evening about getting hurt. His legal team said Dispenza relayed his alleged injuries to ringside physician Dr. Michael Sampson, director of performance psychology Chris Manzione, and a member of the athletic training staff. Dispenza claims Sampson was upset over the situation, saying that all stunts or interactions outside the ring must be approved by Sampson beforehand. Sampson was near Dispenza when the incident occurred. He said Sampson asked him to go see the training staff. Dispenza's representation told the Takedown on SI that he was eventually told he would not be treated any longer by the AEW athletic training staff and that the incident was never acknowledged again. It also said Dispenza and Moxley never discussed the incident beyond briefly after the segment. His team says he's looking to obtain compensation for injuries suffered due to the actions of the wrestler and the company he worked for, and the filing says the amount in controversy exceeds $25,000. And by the way, I see some people saying, oh, it's such a low dollar amount, you know, it's just, what's the big deal? Just pay it and get it over with. I think that it doesn't mean that he's suing for $25,000 or $30,000. There must be some threshold and it exceeds 25. It could be 250 for all we know. It doesn't mean he's suing for 25K. It claims he incurred damages, including but not limited to medical expenses, disability, permanent and serious disfigurement, wage loss and lost earnings capacity, pain and suffering, exemplary damages for mental and emotional anxiety, humiliation and/or indignity. Well, I mean, now we're just getting ridiculous here. Diminution to business, reputation, and opportunities, other economic and non-economic damages not yet known, and all other damages available under Michigan law. The lawsuit states that the extent of his injuries are still unknown at this time. Defendant Moxley's actions did harm the plaintiff, the extent of which is still unknown, as plaintiff continues to have physical issues related to the incident. The Takedown on SI reached out to an AEW spokesperson regarding the lawsuit and the allegations, to which they replied, AEW does not comment on pending litigation. A status conference for the lawsuit is scheduled for August 29th. And then there's some other points here that I pulled from elsewhere from the actual lawsuit, just about the incident real quick. Plaintiff was tasked with holding a screwdriver for defendant Moxley to use during the performance. Plaintiff was not a performer and was not warned of spontaneously becoming one. Plaintiff held the screwdriver for Moxley to take from his hand as intended and scripted. Upon receiving the item and without warning, explanation, or prior discussion, defendant Moxley unexpectedly deviated from the planned script by placing his hands on plaintiff's face and shoulder and violently shoving him to the ground. Plaintiff sustained extensive injuries as a result of this violent and unscripted assault, ultimately culminating in a surgical procedures of cervical spine surgery, shoulder surgery, plus other serious injuries that necessitate significant medical treatment. I did see video of the shove that is described here, and it does look very mild. I mean, you would read this and think that, man, he got shoved with such violent force. It doesn't come across that way in the video. But so, of course, a lot of people are making fun of this and mocking this. And, you know, he's just trying to get money. He's faking it. He's lying and this and that. I would assume that this man has medical records and has, you know, some receipts, so to speak, that he is bringing to the table here. There's a lot we don't know here. As far as what people like Tony Khan knew or did not know about this, he says he talked to three different people at the time about the incident, but he didn't file a report. He didn't report it to anybody, and he was still working with the company, you know, not directly, but it's not as if he stopped doing all work for AEW after this incident. So there's a lot of questions about this lawsuit. But here's the reality of the situation and why this guy's going to get paid. If the guy did get hurt, and it would be very easy to prove, you know, whether or not, you know, he had a cervical injury, cervical, you know, operation of some kind, you know, was there a pre-existing injury? Like, this should all be easily provable. If the guy did get hurt, and he's looking to use the legal system here a couple years later for the purposes of getting his medical bills paid, because he's got this mound of medical bills that just continuing to mound. This is a country where you can easily go bankrupt, okay, for medical debt. Then more power to him. Tony Khan can easily cut the guy a check and make all this go away and not bat an eyelash. Reality is, if he really wasn't given a heads up that Moxley was going to put his hands on him, no matter how tame the shove may have looked in the video, they bear at least some of the responsibility here regardless. Pay the man and be done with it. And then put a policy in place to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. Because if you have someone who is not trained and is not part of the show, they should not be taking bumps without first giving them a heads up and getting their permission. That's very stupid. That's not how you run a company. I mean, this has nothing to do with people being soft or oversensitive or, oh my God, the video, I saw the video, it's such a joke, it didn't even look that bad. Like, they're not part of the show. You shove someone to the ground, they could easily get hurt. They could hit their fucking head on something. Anything can happen. It's one thing to let them know, hey, look, I'm gonna shove you to the ground. Are you cool with that? But if that's not what happened here, then yes, Moxley and or AEW bears at least some, if not a lot, of the responsibility here, in my view, which is why this guy's going to get paid. At the end of the day, I think that's how this ends. This ends with him getting paid, and AEW needs to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again, because you should never put your hands on somebody like that. It's one thing to, like, you grab them by the lapels, you know, or something like that to intimidate them. But if you're going to physically shove someone to the ground and not even give them a heads up that you're going to do something like that, then this is the sort of thing that could happen. And there's nobody that should be defending that aspect of this case. And no matter what you think of the actual shove itself, it's almost irrelevant here. The man was assaulted. Pay up. Now, Tony Khan gave an interview to Yahoo Finance regarding the Warner Brothers Discovery split, as well as cable TV ratings for Dynamite and Collision. This is from the Yahoo Finance story. The looming breakup of struggling TV player Warner Brothers Discovery won't body slam All Elite Wrestling's business, says CEO Tony Khan. We have great relationships with everybody at the top, both on global networks and streaming and studios, Khan told Yahoo Finance at the Cannes Lions International Festival of Creativity on Tuesday. Mr. Zaslav himself put our deal together. Gunnar Wiedenfels, the CFO, who will be running their global networks, also was very involved in our deal. So if you didn't hear the news a few weeks ago, Warner Brothers Discovery is planning to split into two separate publicly traded companies. One is going to be called Warner Brothers Discovery Streaming and Studios, and the other one is Warner Brothers Discovery Global Networks, which would include TNT and TBS and CNN and all of that stuff. And the split is not expected to be completed until the middle of next year. It's not going to be like an immediate thing. But this is, you know, not unusual in the media space. Comcast separated their TV operations from its streaming assets as well. You know, my initial thoughts on the news, and I didn't make a big deal of it when it was first reported, because I don't see this having any short-term impact whatsoever on AEW. It may not even have a long-term impact on AEW, but whatever the long-term impact is, we're still a couple of years away from knowing what that would even be. You know, whenever their existing media rights deal is up, it could have an impact at that point. But there's no point in speculating on what may or may not happen in 2027, because in 2025 and 2026, it's not going to have any impact on AEW. Now, also included in this story is an interesting little nugget here. It says, besides the big media breakups, the operating landscape for AEW is ever shifting. In September 2023, Endeavor completed a $21 billion merger between WWE and UFC, forming TKO Group. Netflix began exclusively streaming WWE's flagship Raw show in January as part of a $5 billion 10-year media rights deal. Speculation has since surfaced that TKO Group may look to unload WWE. Speculation, you say? Apparently they're getting their speculation from X or from Jonathan Coachman. Where else is this speculation coming from? I've seen absolutely nothing to back this up. But the website Awful Announcing also covered some of what Tony said in that Yahoo Finance interview, in particular the rating stuff, and the key headline coming out of it being, Tony Khan says AEW cable audience is growing in spite of 24% viewership drop. Tony said, we're doing fantastic. This is a huge year for us. We grew the business so much with the simulcast that we've brought in new audience with Max and streaming, but also we've been able to grow our cable audience year over year. Now let me stop there. The idea that AEW is having a huge year is true. If you look at it from a financial perspective, given they signed a new media rights deal, you know, late last year with Warner Brothers Discovery, so they're going to be making more money off that deal than they ever have before. Even though those terms were not publicly disclosed, the Sports Business Journal at the time reported that the deal is worth upwards of $170 million a year. Now, I've also seen, I think it was Variety said $150 million. Let's be generous and go with the $170 million, okay? $170 million a year for 3 years with an option for a fourth year, which would bring the deal up over $600 million. So AEW is rock solid in that regard. You can't say that they don't have any money coming in. Now, they're also spending a lot of money, but they've got a lot more money coming in now than they did before, right? There's no other professional wrestling company, sports entertainment, call it whatever you want, in the world outside of WWE that has any sort of media rights deal bringing in that kind of revenue, okay? So that is true. The stuff about growing their cable audience year over year, though, I have no idea what orifice he's pulling that out of. The article continues, when confronted with skepticism over growing his cable audience for AEW, Khan doubled down. Said a lot of people thought when you start simulcasting AEW on Wednesday nights and Saturday nights, oh, okay, a lot of people, they're still going to watch the show, but people are going to migrate to streaming. Well, actually, our cable audience, when we started simulcasting, went up. And we have a great audience on Max streaming every week as well. So we have been able to do that, and we've really maintained and grown a great audience over the years. AEW, we say, is where the best wrestle, and I really believe that's true. The WrestleNomics website tracks weekly television ratings in the wrestling industry. AEW has actually seen precipitous ratings declines so far in 2025 compared to 2024. In fact, AEW Dynamite was down a whopping 24% in audience in Q1 this year. The raw numbers show that AEW was down 44% from their peak back in 2021 for Dynamite. That makes it really hard to sell that your company is doing better than it ever has, especially since low attendance has caused AEW to now run theaters and ballrooms for their weekly shows instead of larger arenas. AEW is up a slight amount so far this year compared to 2024 Q4, but that's not how anybody measures year-over-year growth by picking and choosing what quarters you want to compare. There's also great mystery over what exactly AEW is drawing on Max, as neither the company nor the streamer has released any real audience numbers. But given their viewing trends, at least in the sports world, it would be hard to fathom the Max audience coming anywhere close to what AEW draws on cable. Yes, AEW is not drawing 500,000 additional viewers on Max every week. I know that was a thing a few months ago after the BJ Bethel report. There's no way they're drawing anything close to that week to week on Max. But without seeing the numbers, we don't know exactly how much to add on to the cable numbers from TBS and TNT. And he didn't say that they're up when you include the Max numbers. He very specifically said they were up even absent those streaming numbers, and that's just, it's just demonstrably false. With the Max numbers included, yes, they're probably up from what they were doing a year ago. And that's a good thing. But to hear him say what he said, it's like he's living in his own little fantasy world, you know, somewhere outside of the realm of reality. What he should be happy about, though, were the numbers that their Arena Mexico show did on Wednesday, which were way up. 736,000 overnight viewers on TBS, which is a 23% jump from the week before, and a 46% jump from this time last year, which I believe is still the lowest rating that the show has ever done. The key demo number this week was also way up. With the Max numbers factored in, again, not knowing exactly what they are, but do I think they're 500,000 a week? No. Do I think they're 50,000 a week? No, I think it's higher than that. Somewhere in the middle, right? So somewhere in between. What the number is, we don't know. But if you factor the Max numbers into that 736,000, they were probably close to a million. I don't think they hit a million, but they were probably close to a million. So he has good reason to celebrate that. As far as the Arena Mexico show, I love the environment, I love the visual, I love the look and the feel and the energy from the crowd. That crowd at Arena Mexico was fucking great. It was a special show, and I would love to see them go back and do this once a year, at least once a year, maybe twice, they could pull it off. So that aspect of the show was great. You strip that away, though, the show itself was just above average. It really wasn't like a great show. The crowd and the atmosphere and everything is what really made it what it was. And I know a lot of talents who were there, they wanted to be on the show. And for them, it was a very special thing to be able to say that they got to perform at Arena Mexico. And that's all well and good. Mercedes Moné won the CMLL Women's World Championship from Zeoxy. That win gave Moné 6 belts. She now has the TBS Championship, the CMLL title, the RevPro British Women's title, which is technically comprised of 2 physical belts, the EWA title that she won 2 weeks ago in Vienna, Austria, and the Owen Hart Foundation belt that she won in this year's tournament. Will she make it 7 in Texas next month at All In? It seems very likely right now. But you could tell how much it meant for her to be at Arena Mexico. There was an interview backstage after the show, and they mentioned that she became the first woman ever to perform at Madison Square Garden, Wembley Stadium, the Tokyo Dome, and Arena Mexico. And it was kind of out of character. It was an out-of-character interview, and you could tell how much that meant to her. And you could tell how much she's really just enjoying this run that she's, which, I mean, she's got no reason not to enjoy this run that she's on. She keeps adding hardware every other week, it feels like, and she's being able to go out there and work on her own schedule, you know, and work matches all over the world in different countries and different places. And she's a wrestling fan. She's a true wrestling fan. So I don't doubt that all of these accomplishments and all of these milestones that she's been hitting, they mean a lot to her. Now, what it's going to mean for the women's division, you know, in the long term as time goes on, and when it comes time for her to drop that TBS championship and start losing matches, you know, what it's going to mean for the women who beat her and the division as a whole, that remains to be seen. Right now, it's the Mercedes show. And you certainly look at this and hope that whatever the end goal is here, that there's more than just Mercedes on the other end who's going to benefit from this. Like I said, that remains to be seen. But we had a big return as well. This did not air on TV. This did not air on Dynamite, but there was a big return at Arena Mexico in the form of the American Dragon, Bryan Danielson, who has not been seen since Wrestle Dream last year and his match with Jon Moxley. But after Dynamite, Blue Panther beat Lee Moriarty in a match that was taped for Ring of Honor. And it was originally a pure title match. It ended up being non-title since they wanted Blue Panther to win. After the match, the Infantry attacked Panther. Shane Taylor laid out Panther with a splash. He went to the top rope. He was going for a splash when Bryan Danielson's music played. And this got the biggest reaction on the show other than Mystico, because Mystico's entrance was the highlight of Dynamite on Wednesday. And he made the save, along with Mascara Dorada and Hologram. And he laid out, he got physical too. He took a bump. He laid out Taylor with the Busaiku knee. And then he led the crowd in Yes Chance, and the show ended with Danielson hugging Blue Panther. So this had absolutely nothing to do with storylines. This had nothing to do with the Death Riders. And this was Bryan Danielson wanting to go out there because, I mean, they showed him in the audience, I think during the show, that I saw a photo. He was geeking out watching the show. This was Bryan Danielson just wanting to have a moment and to go out there and to experience, you know, what it's like to appear before and perform in front of that crowd there in Arena Mexico. And for all the people on social media, and there were some, I don't want to make it sound like there were a ton of them, but I did see people who were complaining and, oh my God, I can't believe this is what they do with Bryan Danielson, his first appearance since the Death Riders, you know, killed him off. And this is what they, it was a moment for him and the live crowd. It did not air on TV for that purpose, because at some point, maybe at All In, we will see Bryan Danielson again. You know, maybe if they do a WrestleMania 40-esque Avenger, you know, kind of Avengers type of ending to the show in the World Championship match, maybe he'll be part of that. Maybe he'll go out there and, you know, attack the Death Riders and hit a Busaiku knee on Wheeler Yuta or something like that. So I don't see what the issue is here. Who gives a shit? It was off camera. It was off. I mean, even if they throw it on Ring of Honor, no one's watching. Who gives a shit? Like, what is the big deal? I mean, I already knew this to be true, but like, you can easily tell when there are people who will simply shit on AEW for the sake of shitting on AEW. Like, there are very legitimate criticisms and things to shit on them for. When I see stuff like this, I just shake my head, because they're just, it's people exposing themselves. They're making such a big deal. You would think that he was actually on Dynamite this week, on screen, on camera, doing something like this. It's not a big deal. Get over it. Athena, who is currently the Ring of Honor Forever Champion, she is the Ring of Honor Women's Champion for 900 plus days. She gave an interview to Sports Illustrated. And this is from the SI story here. After their first match against each other went so well, Athena is hoping to have a more expansive storyline with Mercedes Moné. She said, "It left me wanting so much more. It left me wanting to do a full storyline with Mercedes. I feel like I hold myself on such a high pedestal because I feel like I always have people depending on me. Down from my indie company," if she's an owner, but for those who don't know, she owns, or she's an owner, there might be more than one, in Metroplex Wrestling out of Bedford, Texas, so she has her own promotion. "So down from my indie company to my Ring of Honor locker room, we put our hearts on a platter, and I felt like in that moment, I was proud of myself. Monet defeated Athena on the April 16th episode of Dynamite in Boston, advancing in the Owen Hart tournament. After watching back her match with Mercedes, the fallen goddess said she experienced the feeling that she had been chasing for nearly a decade. Not since her second bout against Asuka at NXT TakeOver Brooklyn 3 had Athena felt such a level of satisfaction with the finished product. I just remember having a tear come to my eye, and I don't really get too emotional, she said. There's been a few times that I've cried. My most recent was Japan because I wanted it so bad. But I was just kind of swelling with pride because it was just magic for me. It was like I found a true equal in the ring to me on every level who countered my chaos. Monet spoke very highly of Athena after their match and expressed that she's hoping to see Athena featured on AEW television more. Athena is on a dominant 900-plus day run as Ring of Honor Women's Champion, but has not crossed over to AEW much. She hasn't crossed over at all up until this week. Since being moved to ROH. Sports Illustrated writes that Athena could not put over Tony Khan and his company enough for allowing her the opportunity to simply enjoy the art of professional wrestling again. She would love to compete in her home state of Texas at All In next month, but does not know if that will happen. I don't know if that's in my stars, she said. If not, I have a Ring of Honor pay-per-view that I will probably be defending my championship on. You know, I would probably be super bummed out if I was not on All In, but honestly, there's still time. It says ROH Supercard of Honor is being held in Arlington on Friday, July 11th, which is the night before All In. And wouldn't you know, look who popped up on Collision last night in what they billed as an all-star eight-woman tag team match. It was Athena, Megan Bain, Penelope Ford, and Tekla against Thunder Rosa, who's been building a feud with Athena in Ring of Honor lately, Ty Mello, Anna Jay, and Queen Aminata. Finally, the woman comes out from behind the paywall. And had they not moved that Ring of Honor pay-per-view to the night before All In, I would say Athena defending her title against Thunder Rosa probably would have been on that show, but now it seems more likely that match would happen the night before. So I don't know what that means for her getting a spot on the All In card now. I hope she does. I mean, there's always the pre-show, I guess. But I've talked about this before. Like, it's so bewildering to me how we have other Ring of Honor champions, Bandido and Dustin and Sammy, who have appeared, you know, fairly regularly on AEW television, whether it's Dynamite or Collision. And Athena has been the exception to the rule. You know, she has made some appearances on Dynamite, but you could count them on one hand probably in the last 3 or 4 years. That's how few there have been. And I said this the other day on Twitter. I said, what I think, my two cents, I think Tony Khan wanted to make Athena one of the centerpieces or the crown jewel of a potential Ring of Honor TV deal, right? It's why he put the Ring of Honor championship on Chris Jericho. And he saw Athena for the women being at that level, right? She's going to be the female face, if not the face, of a Ring of Honor show. And we're going to shop this thing around and try to get a TV deal. And the problem, and he had the chance a few years ago. There was interest from the CW, but he turned him down. He didn't even want to really explore those conversations because he was more interested in trying to build a relationship with Warner Brothers Discovery. And he was hopeful and optimistic that they would have an interest in Ring of Honor and they would be able to get the show on one of their networks. And that didn't happen. You know why? Because nobody gave enough of a shit about Ring of Honor to give him that deal. And that was like 3 years ago. And here we are now, all these years later, and still no TV deal for Ring of Honor. And so Athena is toiling away here behind their paywall. And for whatever reason, he just does not want to put her on television very often. And she's one of the best that they have. But it's okay for the other champions to be on TV, but not her. So at least she popped up last night. Maybe that's a sign that we'll get to see her a little more often, maybe. I know it was only Collision, but it's something, right? It's something. It's a starting point. Now we have to get her on TV a little more frequently because there's no reason that we shouldn't be seeing her on TV if we can see people like Bandita or Billy Starks. Doesn't make any sense. Athena wasn't the only one to show up on Collision last night. We had a big return. After more than a year away from AEW, Kota Ibushi made his appearance on Collision last night. started with an in-ring promo segment featuring Kazuchika Okada being introduced out as the newest member of the Don Callis family, and he's out there with all of them, and Callis is verbally running down Kenny Omega, said that if he makes it to All In, he will truly be alone. And that brought out Mark Briscoe on stage. Came out to make it clear that Omega has friends like himself, but he's not his only friend. And that's when they hit the video, they hit the music, and out came Kota Ibushi, who looked like a completely different person from the last time we saw him. This looked like the Ibushi of old. Came out there, no shirt on or anything. He was ripped. And Briscoe went, immediately charged at Lance Archer. And as that chaos is going on in the aisleway, Ibushi is just, he's slowly walking. It's like something out of a movie. Slowly walking down to the ring and took out Josh Alexander. Went toe-to-toe with Okada. Okada laid in a few shots. Ibushi unloaded on him, sent him out of the ring. And look, I mean, there's obviously a lot of history between Okada and Ibushi. I mean, they've had matches over the years, but the last time that we saw Kota Ibushi in a New Japan ring was the finals of that G1 Climax in 2021 when he got hurt and Okada ended up getting the win because of a ref stoppage. That's the last time we've seen them one-on-one in the ring together. And it was announced later on that Ibushi is going to be back in the ring on Dynamite this upcoming Wednesday. So from what we saw of him, which was brief, but what we saw of him last night, this really did look like the Kota Ibushi of old. The closest thing to that that we have seen, certainly in all the time that we've seen him in AEW, which isn't very long, but he was definitely not looking like his old self the last time we saw him. Even the way that he was moving around, he was very hurt. He was very beat up. He had ankle issues. And then, like, he's been out for so long, and there were these reports that he didn't want to have surgery for this, and he was rehabbing in his own way from these other injuries. And it's like, dude, just get the surgery or just do what the doctors tell you to do so you can get back in the ring. You know, he's 40 years old. It's not like he's getting any younger here. But you see him out there on Collision last night. Not only does he look great, but he was actually moving more like his old self. So I'm like, has Ibushi finally embraced modern medicine? It looks like it. He's embraced something, whatever it is. If we can get something like this, something like the old Ibushi back on AEW television, then watch out. You know, that's going to be a lot of fun. So he'll be on Dynamite this Wednesday. It came out of nowhere. I haven't even heard his name mentioned lately, but it makes sense because obviously him and Kenny Omega, the Golden Lovers, and their tag team and their friendship going back many years, it does make sense to kind of weave him into this story. I don't know if that ends up with a Kota Ibushi Kazuchika Okada match at some point on TV between now and Texas. That would seem to make sense. They didn't announce that match for Wednesday, but maybe he's back in the ring on Wednesday to set up maybe for the following week, a big match between him and Okada on TV. You know, it doesn't have to be for the title. Just doing Okada against Ibushi would be big. And maybe that's where they bring back Kenny Omega. In fact, that's exactly what I think they're probably going to do. That makes all the sense in the world. If you do Okada and Ibushi, we'll probably get some bullshit DQ finish. And he's being outnumbered, right, by all the members of the Callis family. Mark Briscoe comes out. They're still outnumbered. And then, boom, you hit the music, and here comes Kenny Omega. I think that's exactly what we're going to get. Got some injury updates here for you real quick. Hook, who has a new short film out called Money Talks that just premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. It's about the adventure of a $100 bill in 1981 New York City. I saw the trailer. It looks like he's got a very small part in it, but he is in there. He says that he's been out recovering from a concussion, but he should be back in the ring soon. He was on Wrestling Observer Live on Friday. He said, "I'm recovering from a concussion for those who don't know, but I've been out for a while and should be back soon." Last time he wrestled was on Dynamite back on April 9th in Baltimore. I think that was the Dynamite after Dynasty. And he was in a tag match. He was teaming with Samoa Joe against Claudio and Wheeler Yuta of the Death Riders. And if you remember, during that match, it appeared, and I didn't even realize it until after the fact, but it appeared that he vomited not once but twice in the ring. There was once during the match and then once during the post-match angle where Claudio gave Hook a neutralizer onto a steel chair. So he vomited the first time, and that's probably a sign that he was concussed. Pretty safe to say. But they continued to shoot the angle and continued to abuse this guy, which is not so good when you have a concussion. So the video of him throwing up, of course, it went viral on social media. And initially it was reported that, nope, he did not have a concussion. But his own statement on Wrestling Observer Live would refute that. And the last time we saw him, he did return to Double or Nothing. He made a very brief run-in during Anarchy in the Arena. Remember? And the other members of the Ops, they were like, hey, it's good to have you. Come on in the ring. And he kind of shook his head and he walked off. So we may be getting a jealous Hook when we see him back on TV. Jealous that he was replaced so easily and so quickly by Powerhouse Hobbs. And this news is a couple of weeks old now, but Brian Cage recently took to Instagram to reveal that he underwent knee replacement surgery to treat excessive knee pain that he had been dealing with for many years. But he's already back in the gym. He said, 4 days post-knee replacement, 8 weeks post-quad tendon repair, and I'm already back in the gym. And it had him in the post. There were clips of him. He was pumping iron, and he was doing all the things that he does in the gym. It says, love me, hate me, or somewhere in between, you can't deny that I'm a fucking machine. And he wrote that he had intended to hold off on surgery until after All In, but decided to go under the knife once he tore his quad. He says, I've been dealing with excessive knee pain for years and have been working through it with the intention of going under the knife after All In. With the unfortunate setback of tearing my quad, I figured, fuck it, let's just get them both done. Not an easy or fun choice, but I'm going to come back ripping heads off, especially if this is me right now after surgery. So he's been out of action since the middle of March. He and Lance Archer were originally supposed to challenge the Hurt Syndicate at Dynasty for the AEW Tag Team titles, but he hurt his leg working an independent date. He wasn't even working an AEW date, and that's where the injury happened, and that's what forced a change in plans, and we ended up with Big Bill and Brian Keith taking their spot. But it's kind of unique because you don't really hear about current active wrestlers in any of the major companies who undergo a knee replacement. You know, usually that's something you hold off on until after your career is over. So, I mean, all the best to him. I mean, I assume they told him that he can make a full recovery. I'm trying to think if there are any active wrestlers his age, like in WWE or AEW, that are wrestling with a knee replacement, like a fake knee. I don't know of any. I don't want to say he's the first, but it's just not something you hear about very often. And one last note here on AEW. This is just too good not to mention, because it was news this week. It was a big story. The Beast Mortos is just having the time of his life right now. And it was capped off, well, I mean, it was capped off in the main event on Dynamite because he got to wrestle at Arena Mexico for the first time in something like 11 years. You know, he once upon a time was part of CMLL. And I want to say maybe it was 2011. He made the jump to AAA. And that's just something you don't do. I mean, that's just a mortal sin. The hatred between the two companies is very real. It's very palpable. And he basically was banned from Arena Mexico. Tony Khan personally went to the head of CMLL to request that they allow the Beast to be part of that main event on Wednesday. Claudio was supposed to be in it. It was a big 10-man tag. He couldn't make the show. They didn't say why. And so the Beast Mortos took his place. He got to make his Arena Mexico return. This is after TMZ reported that Mercedes Moné and the Beast Mortos have confirmed that they are dating. They are the new power couple in pro wrestling. So after Morto shared a photo with Moné on Instagram, the TBS champion confirmed their relationship to TMZ Sports, joking that it's a real Beauty and the Beast situation. So not only is he back at Arena Mexico, not only is he dating Mercedes Moné. See, now she found somebody who can carry all of her belts around. Not only that, but even before all of that, the Beast Mortos wrote on social media that he has officially passed his law exam and he will become a licensed lawyer in the next few months. And he even shared a photo of his exam scores, which include a 9.0 in civil law, an 8.3 in professional composition, an 8 in minor offenses, a 9.9 in civil procedural law, and an 8.03 overall average. And he celebrated the milestone by writing, "Officially, in a few months, I will be a lawyer. If you don't want to pay your ex-wife a divorce settlement, call me. I'm still learning to speak, but I can help you. Roar!" So this guy is just on cloud nine right now. I mean, you got Frank the lawyer over here. Mercedes got her a lawyer. Look at this. But not only is he a lawyer, he's a wrestler. Now, you know that if he had taken a meeting, let's say that this guy is transported back to mid-90s, WWF, and Vince McMahon is like, "We're going to send the limo. I want you to come up to Connecticut. I want you to come to Stanford and we'll have a meeting," right? And he goes in there and Vince says, "Tell me a little something about yourself." "Well, I passed the law exams." "Really?" You know full well what gimmick this guy would have ended up with. At a time when we had a wrestling accountant, and we had a wrestling plumber, and we had a wrestling garbage man, and so on and so forth. We would have had ourselves a wrestling lawyer. He would have been out, he would have been like IRS. He would have been out there with the button-down shirt, tie, Halliburton. Actually, it would have been an exact carbon copy of IRS. I guess IRS kind of looked like a lawyer, now that I think about it. I don't know. There might have been a little conflict there with those two gimmicks, but it was a different time. It's a different time. He's lucky to come up now and not back then. Anyway, some other news and notes real quick before I get into your questions. A week after announcing they were pregnant, Rob Van Dam and his wife Katie Forbes made another big announcement Thursday during their One of a Kind podcast. They are expecting twin girls. The twins will be born sometime in 2026. And it will be the first kids for both of them. RVD is 54 years old. Katie is 34. They've been married since 2021. And I saw Mike Johnson mention that Tommy Dreamer and Danny Doring's families, they also have twin girls. So something may have been in the air or the water there at the corner of Swanson and Rittner back in the day. I don't know which, but that's pretty crazy. Congrats to the two of them. And a few weeks ago, Ric Flair revealed that he was about to undergo treatment for skin cancer for the second time in 3 years. He was diagnosed with melanoma, and he had to cancel a scheduled appearance this past Tuesday because of it. Melanoma is the deadliest of all the skin cancers. It's all about early detection. The earlier you catch it, the better your odds of survival are. Because once you get to stage 3 and stage 4, your chances greatly diminish. So I don't know what stage his cancer is. Hopefully it was caught early. Meanwhile, Hulk Hogan was back in the hospital this week after a neck fusion surgery that he had last month. And his former friend, Bubba the Shit Sponge, on his radio show, claimed that he heard from a reliable source that Hogan was back in the hospital and he was on his deathbed, to the point that family members were being called to come in and say their goodbyes, claiming he might not make it. And he thinks that it may be a heart issue. But he was very careful to keep saying, "allegedly," over and over again, "and I'm not sure," "and it might not be true," but didn't stop him from saying it and making it sound like Hogan was on his last legs. Eric Bischoff issued a statement later on denying this and saying that Hogan had a successful cervical surgery and is experiencing an adverse reaction. But he's doing well and doctors expect him to make a full recovery. And that's good news. No matter what I think of Hulk Hogan or what I think of Ric Flair, I don't want to see them dead. And anybody wishing death on them or rejoicing at the news that Flair has cancer or Hogan may have been on his deathbed is out of pocket. Okay, there's no excuse for that. It's wrong. Just like Flair was wrong to make that stupid comment about Jim Ross a few weeks ago about seeking attention, as always, when JR was recovering from cancer surgery. There's no excuse for that. It's wrong, and if I see any comments like that on my timeline, you won't be on my timeline anymore. But between Flair and Hogan, Jim Ross being diagnosed with colon cancer, Undertaker just talked on his podcast about having surgery for a heart issue after WrestleMania, it sucks getting old. Even Francine from ECW, she's not as old as those guys are, but on her podcast, she said doctors found a mass in her left breast, and she's waiting to find out if it's cancerous or not. Apparently, she had the same thing when she was 21 years old, and it turned out not to be cancer. I hope she gets a similar report this time. All right, mailbag time. If you have questions for me and you had them this week, email me, thesolomonster at gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Chris, in Cortland, New York. Haven't been on the streams lately as I've been recovering from liver surgery and have been out of the loop. Catching up in the last few weeks, I can't help but wonder what WWE's thought process is with the recent name changes that they have given to a select few people. That being Ricky Starks / Saints, Jeff Cobb / JC Mateo, and Mariah May / Blake Monroe. The majority of the recent signees have been able to keep their name that they made for themselves elsewhere, like Jade Cargill and Tama Tonga, Tongaloa. That's the great Tongaloa to you. Jacob Fatu, Ethan Page, Sean Spears, Penta, Phoenix, Jordan Grace, Julia, Stephanie Vicaire, all kept their own name. Is it just WWE thinking that these particular names won't get over in WWE? The WWE fan won't know who they are? Perhaps WWE having bigger plans for those in particular, wanting their fame and success to be tied to the WWE likeness, like Gunther. The changes for those three don't make a whole lot of sense to me and kill the momentum and buzz that those people had on the lead up to their arrival. Well, first of all, get well soon, Chris. I hope you're doing well after your surgery. It's a mystery to me as well. I assume it's just tied into talent choice. You know, if there are talents who do not want to sign the necessary paperwork to sign those names over. And it's weird because in some cases, you know, it could be their real name. I don't know the ins and outs of how all that works now as compared to how it used to be in WWE. I mean, you could find other examples over the years where people would have to change their names, but then you would have Samoa Joe, you know, would come in. AJ Styles would come in. How come they didn't have to change their name? I assume it all just comes down to their willingness to license the name or sign their rights over to WWE. You know, I don't know what that fine print looks like in the contracts. I don't know what those agreements look like. It's the only thing that makes sense to me. Like you said, you just rattled off a whole bunch of people who got to keep their names. So how come they got to keep their names and these three didn't? I don't have a good answer for you. Other than it has to, in my view, just come down to their willingness to sign those names over for a specified period of time to WWE. Yeah, they may be like, you know what? I'd like to keep that for myself and let's come up with something new. In other cases, it may well be a situation where they actively want to come up with a new name for themselves. They may go to WWE and say, I want a new name. Maybe WWE gives them the option and they're like, you know what? I want to take on a whole new persona. Right? We don't know. So that's the simple answer. Marlon from Fort Wayne, Texas. I hate that Seth Rollins won Money in the Bank. I don't think he needs it. However, since he does have it, I believe he would really help TNA. Bear with me on this. I could already see where this is going. Trick Williams is the TNA World Champion, and I think Mike Santana will win the title soon. Within the past 24 to 48 hours, an article came out stating that WWE is interested in Joe Hendry, which we all knew, but also in Mike Santana. What if Santana beats Trick for the title after previously losing their last bout? Everyone would celebrate and go wild, and then Seth Rollins' music hits. He comes in, takes the TNA World title from Mike Santana. I think that should happen soon if it's going to happen that way. Roman can then call Seth cause Seth to lose it in the rematch fairly soon and set them up for SummerSlam. I don't think Seth needs another lengthy title reign. He was just the world champion for a year last time he had the belt. This scenario would set up a future match between Rollins and Santana on WWE soil whenever Santana makes the jump, creating an established big program for him. What are your thoughts on this? I feel like this idea would generate buzz across both promotions without having Rollins go for one of the WWE world titles. I applaud you thinking outside the box. I'm not a fan of that idea, and there is, I can't say less than zero, but as strongly as I can say that without saying it, that's about how realistic a chance there is of that happening. Because here's the thing. WWE, yeah, I'm sure they have interest in Mike Santana. They'd be fucking idiots not to. So I'm sure he'll end up there at some point. Joe Hendry will end up there. WWE does not do what they do, especially on the main roster. Because now you're getting into the main roster. You're not even talking NXT anymore. WWE does not give a shit about TNA. What I mean by that is you're proposing an idea, right, that would help TNA. You literally just said, I believe could really help TNA. They don't care. Triple H, maybe Shawn Michaels, you know, has some affinity for TNA. I promise you, Triple H is sitting there and he's trying to come up with these ideas for Raw and SmackDown. The thought of TNA does not even factor into his brain. He doesn't care. They don't do the things they do. They don't develop these stories for the main roster with any regard to helping anybody but WWE. That was your first mistake, assuming that they would want to do anything to help TNA. They don't give a shit. So it's not going to happen. And also, having him cash in for anything other than one of the top titles in WWE doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Because he's gone out there, Rollins has, and Paul Heyman has, and they've talked about, Rollins talked about this even, you know, before winning Money in the Bank and coming out of WrestleMania, that he's trying to change things in his vision. He's trying to help. He needs the championship. The championship is the power source. The championship being whatever the top title is on the brand that he is currently on. Right? Or yeah, I guess he can technically cash in his Money in the Bank for the other belt, but that's the power source right there. Cashing in for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship could set up a future feud down the line for a guy who doesn't even currently have a contract with WWE. Yes, that's true. You could set something up for 2026 between Rollins and Mike Santana, but that's not why they're doing this. And it doesn't make any sense. There's no power in him cashing in for a championship that doesn't even belong to WWE. What does that accomplish for Rollins and Paul Heyman and that faction? Nothing. It accomplishes nothing. It would be a waste of the briefcase. So that is why they're not going to do it. But like I said, you tried to think outside the box. I appreciate that. But if we're going to get down to brass tacks here and talk about reality, it ain't happening. Dak from St. Paul, Minnesota, with the introduction of the AEW Unified title and the Fightful report that it will be positioned as a top-tier title, do you think AEW could be moving towards a brand split with the world title being on one show as the top title and the Unified being the top title for the other? If not, how do you think the Unified title should be used with it being considered a top title? I don't think we're getting a brand split. I don't want to see a brand split. I don't think that's the answer. Whatever issues you think the company has in terms of booking or how they use certain talent on the rosters, I don't think a brand split is the answer. As far as what they can do to make it come off as a top championship, having top names hold it, at least initially, you know, like an Okada or an Omega, that is number one. I mean, that would help. What they could do is treat it like the TNT title used to be treated. The TNT title right now, as compared to kind of where it used to be, has never been lower. And I'm not just blaming Adam Cole for that. It's just, tell me another time when the TNT championship has felt as insignificant as it does right now. You can't, because it has never been as insignificant or felt as insignificant as it does right now. It certainly meant a lot more when Cody had it and Darby had it. If they can do that with the Unified title and treat it like the TNT title used to be treated and close out some shows in the main event with it, that would go a long way towards training people to believe and see it as a top championship in the company. Trevor from Peckham, England. While I was listening to your recent Dynamite review and talking about the possible outcomes for Hangman against Moxley, I had an idea that I wanted you to hear. They could have a WrestleMania 40 style finish where everyone is coming out from both sides. Death Riders, then the Ops to stop them. Young Bucks looking like they're going to try to help Hangman and he doesn't want it. Swerve and Ospreay come out. Then in the style of Solo Sikoa, the returning Pac in a hoodie comes in to take out Hangman. When it looks like Mox is going to win again, all of a sudden Darby Allin's music hits and the place explodes. Before you kill me, not saying it would be the same thing, but like Stone Cold helping The Rock at Backlash 2000, Darby helps take out all the Death Riders and takes out Moxley. Hangman hits his finish and wins the title. He gets the big moment, maybe even a face-off with Swerve, with them shaking hands to a big pop. Meanwhile, coming out of the match, you could set up Moxley against Darby to continue and finish their story. Yeah, that's pretty much what I think they've been setting up for. You know, but the last few weeks, I've become less convinced that Moxley is actually going to drop the title on that show. If he does, I think that it'll pretty much go the way that you just mapped it out. I figure that's why they haven't brought Darby back to TV yet. I mean, he's been back from Mount Everest now for a few weeks. You know, they haven't brought him back to TV. They didn't even bother mentioning his Mount Everest climb on TV, which you would think they would make a big deal about that, and they didn't even mention it. Why would they do that, right? Well, because they want him out of sight, out of mind. They want to make the surprise comeback in Texas a much bigger deal to get revenge on Moxley for what the Death Riders did to him the last time we saw him on TV. I like the added touch, though, that you mentioned about saving the Swerve and Hangman handshake for the end of the show after Hangman wins the title. I like that. I like that visual of saving it for that event after the title win, after the match is over. All the other AEW guys are in the ring, kind of circled around them. They don't know what's going to happen. Oh, shit. Swerve's in the ring and Ospreay's in the background, hands on his head, like, ah, shit, what's going to happen here? And then we get the handshake. I like that. Kevin from Washington, D.C. With the amount of talent in the women's division in WWE, along with the mid-card championships turning the corner in terms of their directions, can an argument be made that the women are more over collectively than the men are? So this was an interesting question. I wanted to make sure I answered this one here. My question to you, when you say that, my question to you is very simple. Are they selling more tickets? How's the Evolution show doing? Do their segments do higher numbers than the men? Are they moving more merch collectively? I don't know. I don't have those metrics in front of me right now. But to me, that's how you determine who's over and who's not. Rhea Ripley is legitimately in the top mix of stars, male or female, in the company in terms of like top tier stars. Her popularity is off the charts, especially her social media numbers. Collectively, they have a lot of popular females right now. Io Sky is pretty popular. Stephanie Vaquer hasn't even been on the main roster very long, but she's very popular. But how do you measure this? How do you determine how over they are? You have to look at the numbers. I can't say they're more over than the men. Are they more over than John Cena? Are they more over than CM Punk? Are they more over than Jey Uso? I don't think so. They have plenty of talent in the division. But I can't sit here and tell you that, you know, collectively right now, the women are more over than the men. I don't know what you can point to base that on. William from Calgary. Now that Ron Killings is officially back in WWE, do you see a possibility that he will become undisputed WWE champion in the year 2026? Breaking Mr. McMahon's record as the oldest WWE champion of all time? No. Doug from Santa Barbara, California. For some reason this morning at the gym when deciding what wrestling podcast to listen to, I typed in Chris Jericho, Chris Benoit, and listened to his Jericho's interview with Nancy's sister from 9 years ago, getting her perspective of events. It wasn't only until they mentioned it happened the weekend of June 22nd that weirded me out, since that was essentially 18 years ago to this exact weekend. Do you think Chris, being how intense and dedicated to the ring he was, that he never truly would have retired? Would we have seen him end up in AEW? I think they would have let him be himself as opposed to maybe a watered-down 2020 WWE version. Yeah, you know, he points this out. The Benoit murder-suicide took place 18 years ago this week. And as far as Benoit and AEW, I mean, Benoit would have been, 52 or 53 years old in 2019 when AEW first started. So I can't say he would not have been wrestling anymore, because we got people even older than that who are still in the ring right now. We have one of them fighting for the World Heavyweight title on NBC next month. So in 2025, would Benoit still be active in the ring? I could see him doing a match here and there. I mean, he wouldn't be, I mean, even part-time, the way Dustin Rhodes is. I don't see Benoit still, you know, kind of having that schedule. Would he have ended up in AEW? I don't know. I mean, it's one of those questions. It's impossible to know. I mean, if he was going to run his own school, if he had some sort of affiliation then with WWE, if they had him working at the Performance Center, right? Because wash away all the horrible stuff that happened at the end of his life, he would have been the elder statesman. He would have been the most respected guy in that entire company, in that locker room, whether he was an active performer, whether he was a coach or an agent. And I'm sure that if he wasn't working full-time at the Performance Center, I mean, they would have him down there coaching and doing seminars, and, you know, he'd be involved in all that stuff. So would he be in AEW? He would have to be deeply unhappy with his position or his pay in WWE to end up in AEW, but, you know, it's impossible to say. It's impossible to say, but I'm sure Tony Khan would have welcomed him with open arms. He would have loved to have had, you know, Benoit from back in the day, you know, on the AEW roster. So it's just, it's impossible to answer that question. Do I think he would have ended up there? I don't think so. I think he still would have had some sort of affiliation with WWE, but who the hell knows? David from Sacramento, California. From Santa Barbara, we head north to Sacramento. I wanted your take on this idea on how to end Mercedes Moné's multiple title reigns. Although I don't have an idea on the who, the story can be as follows. A cocky Mercedes ends up in non-title match against someone leading into a pay-per-view. Looking this match as a night off. All right, so I guess she looks at the match as a night off is what he's saying. Or easy work. She takes the opponent for granted. As a result, she loses her first match. Although shocked, she laughs it off as she is still champion. However, this could be the dark cloud. Going forward, with every title defense that she has, she loses her titles one by one, all until she is left with the one that she started with, the TBS Championship. She cuts a promo one night, and then the person who originally ended her undefeated streak comes out and claims that she was the ripple to lead to Mercedes to this point. Now that I think of it, should this be Athena? Adding in a plot of you took from me, now I'm taking everything from you. Hey, look, any way to get back to Mercedes and Athena is fine with me. I've talked recently about a downward spiral story with her, which I feel like is one of the only ways left to go, because if she goes in there and wins the world championship from Toni Storm in Texas, she will have a stranglehold on both women's titles. And unless she drops one of them immediately, there's nobody who can justify that as being a good thing for the women's division. If she locks up both titles and has them for a few more months, that would be fucking awful. So she's going to have to lose soon. Maybe she'll lose to Tony, but she's going to have to lose soon. When she does, I think that would be the time for her to start dropping those titles one by one. Now, Tony Khan has no creative control over the storylines and match finishes and other promotions. He could certainly, you know, AEW could certainly dictate whether or not he wants his people to, you know, do jobs or not on independent shows, but it's not up to him, you know, how long Mercedes holds the EWA belt. It's not up to him how long CMLL wants to keep their women's world title on Mercedes. If I'm CMLL, I want her to hold that championship for at least a fucking year. I don't want to take that off of her anytime soon. You know, now could Tony exert some creative influence by suggesting, hey, we have this idea for a storyline, and so it would be really helpful if she lost the title in her next match? Sure. Yeah, I mean, if they had a story in mind where she would have to lose all these belts first, he could certainly request that. And I think that would be the way to go. And she just, you know, she starts losing, and it just gets, you know, to the point where she's in her own head. She's kind of losing her mind. She's falling on tough times. Like you said, that dark cloud over her head. And then you just kind of go from there. Maybe when she's reached rock bottom is where Athena reappears, you know, to try to bring out the old Mercedes. Where's that Mercedes that beat me in the Owen Hart tournament? Where's that Mercedes that brought the best out of me? So that could be one way to go about doing it. Roberto from Queens. I saw a clip of Paul Heyman saying that he was made an offer to join the WWF in the early 90s. He would be brought in as a protege to Bobby Heenan and be part of the Heenan family, eventually turning on Bobby, stealing the family away from him, and turning Bobby babyface. How do you feel this would have turned out, and how much would history have changed if Heyman took this offer? So what he's referring to is a story that Heyman told during an Inside the Ropes Q&A that he did in Manchester back in 2016. I had never heard the story before he told it. Heyman was working for WCW at the time, and he had the opportunity to jump ship to the WWF in early 1992. Now, the timeline on this doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I'm not saying the entire story is made up. He may just have his timeline all screwed up. But the idea, according to him, was Bobby the Brain Heenan was going to bring in Paul Heyman, or Paul E. Dangerously, as he was at the time. Maybe not under that name, but Heyman would be brought in as Heenan's protege. And he would be, I think he said, the executive vice president of the Heenan family, right, or whatever the title would be. With the idea that he eventually screws Bobby or manipulates Bobby out of the Heenan family, and he makes it the Heyman family. And it turns Heenan babyface in the process. Bobby would then have about a year-long run as a babyface, and then he would go on to exclusively do commentary with Gorilla Monsoon. But Kip Fry, who was in charge of WCW at the time, for a very brief period of time, he didn't last long in the role before he got replaced by Bill Watts, told Heyman, name your price. What's it going to take to keep you? And Heyman didn't think he would go for it, but he claims he told him, okay, I'll stay if you make me an employee. And Fry told him, great, you'll have your contract assigned tomorrow. And that's why Heyman stayed. Right? How could he say no to that? He claims that made him the first non-announcer performer in the history of the company to ever be made an employee, because everyone else was an independent contractor. And so that's why he stayed. I'm not so sure that someone like Flair or Dusty, you know, didn't at some point have those same privileges that come with employee status given their roles on the creative team. Was Heyman the first? Maybe he thought he was the first. I'm not so sure I believe that, but that's what he claimed. I love the idea of Heenan and Heyman working together. My God, the two greatest managers of all time. It's Heenan, it's Heyman, and then Jim Cornette. So that would have been incredible. And the idea of Heyman usurping him as the leader, again, the timeline makes no sense to me if we're talking 1992, because Heenan had already been done with managing by that point. But what, so like in 91, I think the fall of 91, because he was put with Flair initially, and then it was too much for him being on the road with Flair, and that's when he basically stopped being a manager at that point. But what I don't like is the idea of Bobby Heenan as a babyface. It just feels wrong to me. He should never be a babyface. Never. Never, ever, ever. I mean, look, I guess if you were going to do it, though, doing it at the very end of his run as a manager would have made the most sense. I guess there would have been no harm in it for a year, but he needed to be a heel if he was going to do commentary with Gorilla Monsoon. Otherwise, the dynamic between them just doesn't work. Shyamo from South Africa. In hindsight, do you think the invasion storyline should have been saved for 2002? You kick off with Ric Flair coming in and then the NWO and everyone else. Rock and Austin were both babyfaces at the time. You could have gone to WrestleMania 18 with Team WWE being Rock, Austin, Angle, Taker, and Kane against Team WCW represented by the NWO, Flair, and DDP. The last part of what you said there is not a good idea, because I don't know why you would do a match like that at WrestleMania. WrestleMania 18 should not be some big 10-man tag. I mean, it's WrestleMania. You got to have these guys in singles matches up and down the card. WrestleMania 18, if they played their cards right, could have been the first big WWF, WCW supercard. Right? That's what that should have been. And it would not have just been exclusively WWF against WCW. You could have had some WWF matches on the undercard. That's what you should have done with WrestleMania 18. And as far as, you know, doing the invasion in 2002, should it have been saved for then? Yes. Once they had access to more bigger names, that's when you kick off a proper invasion. If you're going to do an invasion storyline of WCW invading WWE, you can't do it with Booker T and DDP. I'm sorry. And I like DDP and I like Booker T. That's not going to work. Booker T, DDP, and then all of the lower to mid-card guys from WCW. Fucking Three Count and Chronic and Lance Storm. Give me a break. You're going to build an invasion around that when you have guys like Hogan and Hall and Nash and Flair and Bischoff and Steiner and Goldberg, Luger, Sting, none of whom came in right away. Once you have access to a decent number of them, what you do, I don't even think you don't even kick off the invasion with Flair. You kick it off with Bischoff and the NWO. Bischoff leading the NWO into an invasion of the WWF. And then at that point, I mean, we could talk about where do you go from there? Do all the ex-WCW guys kind of join in with the NWO? Because that would be weird. Flair with the NWO being on the same side, like, I mean, there's different ways you could have gone with it at that point, but see, I would have had Bischoff lead the NWO, and that's how you kick off the invasion. And then you build to a big supercard at WrestleMania the following year. So I guess that would have been, if they kick the angle off in 02, you save the supercard for WrestleMania 19. If you kick it off in 01, you could do the supercard at WrestleMania in Toronto. Brian, in Reno, Nevada, 2 weeks ago, you touched briefly on Sweet and Sour, Larry Sweeney. One of the first names that comes to mind when discussing wrestling's what-ifs is Jimmy Rave. I always felt that he was a great worker that got heat pretty easily and could have been a strong upper mid-card guy in WWE, if not for his personal issues and horrific medical problems that led to his passing. I can't tell if I'm just looking at his Ring of Honor run with rose-tinted glasses, though. That was when I first started going to Ring of Honor shows in New Jersey, and Jimmy and Prince Nana were always a highlight for me. Do you think Rave could have gone on to the big time, or was he someone that would have seen his best years on the indies? Well, Jimmy did have a run in TNA. I mean, he was part of a team with Lance Archer called the Rock and Rave Infection. And he worked singles there too, but that really was the highlight of his fame there. And it's too bad because he played well as a comedy guy, which is how they used him. As more of like a comedy person on the roster there. And I think it really stifled him. You know, I liked Jimmy when I saw him in Ring of Honor. I think I've told the story of my first Ring of Honor show that I ever went to live. It was the very last one they ever did at the New Yorker Hotel Ballroom, which is right around the corner from the Manhattan Center. They had a giant chandelier above the ring. And, you know, the gimmick with Jimmy was the fans had started throwing rolls of toilet paper at him. So when the fans threw toilet paper at him on this show, got all tangled up in the chandelier. And I know the people who ran the place were not very happy about that. But he knew how to get heat, you know, but it was fun heat. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to kill you type of heat, like old territory heat. Do I think he would have gone on to the big time, like a run in WWE? I don't. But if AEW was around back then, he would have fit like a glove. I think he definitely would have ended up there. And if he would have gotten a shot in WWE, he would have been a lower mid-card guy. Really, though, I think he would have mostly bounced around a few places. Probably would have been a top name on the indies for the most part. It's so hard to say with any certainty because by the late 2000s, he was fighting those demons pretty hard. And that really derailed his career. You know, he had some pretty good matches with CM Punk. I know he credited Punk with helping him a lot. We see what Punk went on to do. Do I think Jimmy would have gone on to those types of heights that like Punk did? No, I don't. And I got a bunch more. I'm gonna save some of these for next week, but we'll end with this one. Jesse from Johannesburg, South Africa. See, I have many fans in South Africa. After every show, you manage to always cite wrestler promos verbatim. Are you writing them down in real time? Do you rewatch the bits again before the show? Or are you like Mike Ross from Suits or something with your memory? Sorry for peeling the curtain a bit. I just really appreciate the incredible effort you put in and was curious. Thank you, Jesse. It's very kind of you. No, I'm typing that stuff up in real time, like a court stenographer, only without the stenographer machine that they use. So he's talking about what I watch the shows during the week, and I go live on YouTube right after. You know, I'm talking about a lot of these promos. I have a regular old laptop keyboard. I ain't got no special machine, and I just type it out on that. So a lot of times when I watch these shows, I've got my head down transcribing what they're saying as fast as I can. And then during the ad breaks, I try to go back and clean it up, you know, because I don't always have to go through everything word for word. So I'll be like, take this part out, or I don't know what I wrote here. Let me clean this up a little bit. I could probably just leave the mistakes in there and still know what I'm saying, but I can't help it. It's my OCD. I have to go back and fix it up. So now I don't do that for every single promo. Some of them I could just summarize the key points, but the longer ones where they cover a lot of points, or like we had the John Cena pipe bomb, right, on Punk on SmackDown on Friday night. So I wanted to make sure I got everything down in that one. So I try to transcribe the entire thing and then just go back and punch it up if need be. Yet another reason that a two-hour show is always going to be easier for me to review than a three-hour show. If you didn't know, now you know. Thank you guys for the questions. Got a ton of them. I'm going to save some of these for next week and work in some new ones. So keep emailing me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. This feels like a good place to end. It's good to be back after missing last weekend. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. You can let me know by leaving feedback or a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. That would be a big help. Next time I'm with you here will be next Sunday. That will be episode 918 of the Solemonster Sounds Off. Technically two podcasts next weekend because I'll also be live on YouTube after Night of Champions. That'll be next Saturday. Before then, though, we have Raw Monday. I'll be live on YouTube for the post show and the post show for Dynamite and the post show for SmackDown. And over on JD's channel on Tuesday for episode 100, the centennial of Tuesday Night Titans. We're going to have a good time that night. Lots to discuss. So until then, be well, stay safe. Especially now, wherever you may be in the world, stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. Stay cool. It's going to be very hot here in New York. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
So Jay took the microphone and you talk about promos that will go down in the annals of history from some of the greatest world champions that we have ever seen. I don't know. I was taken aback by just how amazing this promo was. What would this man have to say about his opponents? He's going into combat tomorrow against John Cena and Logan Paul, but he's going in there against John Cena. Probably the last time he'll ever be in the ring with John Cena at this point. And so Jay Uso gets the microphone. One word. Four letters. Yeet. That was his promo. Very good.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solemonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solemonster.